Honorable members, the office of the Auditor General and the delegates from the Department of Defense and Military Veterans, we're supposed to start this meeting at 9 o'clock. We normally start from the docks. We have 8 minutes behind schedule. We do not have much on our program today. We've got only two items. One is to be presented by the Auditor General. One will come as a response from the department, specifically on the AMG contract. I'm sure that is the underpinning. I see a lot of new faces here. My name is Marisa Stelimutimela. I'm the chairperson of this committee. I'll ask all honorable members to introduce yourselves, and after that we'll have everybody introducing themselves. From my, from here to my left, in that order.
My name is David Mania. I'm a member of the Portfolio Committee on Defense and Military Veterans and the Joint Standing Committee on Defense.
Shahid Issa, member of the Standing Committee, or the Portfolio Committee on
Defense. Captain Pascale, Nilukola Kulish.
My name is Gama, from Mosawen Kosi Ndamba, along with the committee.
Alton Diale, member of this committee. Thank you.
I'm a member of this committee and chairperson of the Joint Standing Committee on Defense.
Representing the Chief Joint Operations on the International Border Fences.
Good morning, I'm Colonel Dirk Lowe. I'm from the Directorate of Vice Force of American Air Force.
Major General Cedric Masters. I am the Chief Director, Air Force Policy and Relations.
Good morning. I'm Brigadier General Martin Orban. I'm the Inspector General of SAMS, and I'm representing the Surgeon General.
Good morning. I'm Dr. Kamini Hishamede, the Chief of Policy Strategy and Planning.
Major General Raman Swan, Chief Military Policy, Strategy and Plan.
Spiwa Sokela, the Chief Financial Officer of the Department.
Good morning, I'm Director Raymond Madu from Defense Supply Chain Division.
Good morning, I'm Ian Cedar, Executive from the Office of the Auditor General.
Good morning, I'm Daniel Barad, also from the Office of the Auditor General.
Good morning, Montasama from the Auditor General.
I guess we are done. You represent people that you came with. They do not introduce themselves. Should I take it that way?
From the Military Veterans Department, Corporate Services. Jim Smith, the EC Senior Executive Division's Joint Ops Division.
I'm Colonel Bertie Cormier, SSO Munitions, representing the Chief of Logistics.
I'm on Polite Chair, Director of Maritime Plans, representing Chief of Navy.
Ines Botana, Parliamentary Media Chair,
everybody in this house must introduce themselves.
Good him.
Thank you very much. Honorable Boy, you may as well just start by introducing yourself. Thank you very much. According to our research, the department constitutes the largest percentage of the total expenditure on the consulting from 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, and then we will now call upon the Auditor General to make a presentation to us, and then thereafter we'll enter into a discussion. Auditor General.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, Chairperson, honorable members, guests. This morning we'll be taking you through a slide pack which summarizes the outcomes of the recently concluded audit on the use of consultants at national departments within South Africa, which included the Department of Defense, which will be specifically the focus of today's session. The slides are presented up onto the screen at the back, which is a bit difficult for some to see, and we have, I think most people do have a pack available. I'm not sure if people are able to follow chairs. Are there no packs?
I think that everybody has the pack. Let me just go.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'll start off, Chairperson, on slide 2, which is just a reminder of the role of the Auditor General of South Africa. Our mandate is to strengthen our democracy by enabling oversight, accountability, and governance in the public sector, and we do this through auditing. In order to build public confidence. Chairperson, before I get into the findings specific to the subject matter at hand, we thought we'll just set the scene in terms of what this report is and the context in which it has been presented. The report that we've provided is a performance audit. Now, we must, at the onset, just bring to the attention of the honorable members that this was not an investigation. That this is a performance audit, and the objectives of performance audits are very different to other kinds of audit, and I'll just spend a minute just to share with you that so that we provide context to what follows. So why did we personally conduct a performance audit on the use of consultants by government? Well, for one, it represents a significant line item in the financial statements of the state. Almost 102 billion rand spent over 3 years. Represent significant expenditure and one which they or necessitated a closer look. We also recognize that South Africa does have a skills crisis and that we have a need for the use of consultants within government. This is not a phenomenon that is unique to us in South Africa. Indeed, governments around the world rely on consultants. And so I must from the onset say that we are not advocating the termination of any relationship with consultants. the purpose of our work really is to say that when we do experience a need, let us go out and get value for money. And that is the purpose of a performance audit, is to really say that when we use something, when we engage in something, are we getting value for money? So certainly, we are not advocating the termination of the use of consultants, merely that we use them in a way in which we get value for money out of that relationship. The relationship that I mentioned, we recognize as one of national importance. It's an equation, which I'll show you towards the end of the presentation, which must work in order for our country to derive the value that we expect out of it. So the partnership between the private sector and the public sector is one of national importance, and one which, when it works, creates synergies, creates a situation where the sum of the whole is greater than the sum of the individual parts. We truly feel, and I'll echo what I said earlier, that the public sector can benefit if these consultants are used correctly. If the needs are bona fide, if they're used in a way that creates value for money, the public sector can benefit tremendously by using consultants in the correct way. We've also conducted this performance audit in large as well as a follow-up to previous audits which were conducted in 96 and 2002. And part of our work was to see what progress has been made since those performance audits were conducted many years ago. Honourable Members, Chair, before I just proceed again, I just want to show you the difference between this work which we are taking today and how it differs from other audits that the Office of the Auditor General conducts. You'll notice that there's two blocks on the presentation pack or on the screen up behind you. Regularity audit is something that you're usually accustomed to. This is the audits that we do on an annual basis, and the regularity audits, or financial audits as we call them, are focused on the financial statements, looking at financial management, looking at the money and whether the accounts are true and fair, and this is, as I said, work that we do annually. Now, on the other end, we have performance audits, which is the subject of today's discussion. Performance audits focus on, as I said, value for money. It focuses on performance in respect of what we call the three E's. And you hear us talk about the three E's throughout the presentation as we present the report and as we present the findings. These three E's essentially are economy, efficiency, and effectiveness. Economy relates to, are we getting things at the right price, the right quality, the right time? And it talks about, are we buying in the most optimal way? Efficiency talks about the relationship between the inputs and the outputs. Is that an optimal relationship? Is there room to improve getting more out with less? And effectiveness talks about, do we achieve the objectives that we set out to achieve when we embark on any project? So these three components of economy, efficiency, and effectiveness inform us as an office as to whether we're getting value for money out of any transaction. Now, just taking a second just to talk about the scope of this audit before we get into the specifics. The departments that were audited, and obviously why some weren't, the slide on page 5, the diagram there, shows the split of this 102 billion between national departments and provincial departments. You'll notice that the national departments account for almost 33% of the spend, of our spend as a state, and that is really the focus of the work that we've done and tabled in Parliament now. It accounts for almost 33.5 billion rand. The provincial, you'll notice in the green, accounts for 67% of the total, roughly 68.5 billion rand, and work on that is progressing. We will, in the next couple of months, be tabling reports at a provincial level that account for that 68.5 billion rand. So which departments were audited and why others were not? The report that we tabled in Parliament focused on 8 national departments. The total expenditure by these 8 national departments over 3 years accounted for 24.6 billion rand. Now, 24.6 billion out of 33.5 odd billion, you'll notice that these 8 departments which represent roughly 20% of the national departments, account for 74% of the expenditure. And so this guided our selection as well in terms of our sampling to say what is the best bang for buck from the use of our audit resources. The selection was also guided by the outcomes of our other audit work, the regularity audit work, the financial audit outcomes, as well as previous performance audits that pointed to certain problems. So the department selected, as you'll note, are down the right-hand side of that diagram. Honourable members, before I delve into the findings, I'll just take a second to share with you the focus areas of the audit. And this again will create a bit of context when we start walking through the specific issues. As I said again, these are areas that we looked at to see how do we achieve value for money from the use of consultants. How do we use consultants in a way that's economical? How do we use consultants in a way that is efficient? And how do we use consultants in a way that is effective that helps us achieve the objectives we set out for? You can just, Shalil, just bring up the whole diagram. Essentially, our examination took the form of a life cycle approach that talked about from the time you start using consultants, when you go through planning and appointment, what are the processes that you go through, and how is this done? Are there opportunities, as I said, to improve the efficiency and effectiveness and economy? We then looked at the aspects of internal capacity to say, one, do you have enough staff? Firstly, is the reason you're using consultants because you don't have the people yourself, you don't have the capacity yourself, or is there sufficient capacity that when you bring a consultant in board, that they will be able to take the deliverables and implement them? So there are a number of different aspects that went into that. We then looked at training and transfer skills from the use of consultants, and this is an area I think where consultants can be of real benefit to the state. Where we go out and use consultants because there is a need for certain skills that the state does not have, there really exists an opportunity for transfer of those skills from the private sector to the public sector. However, this does not happen automatically. It needs to be managed. It needs to be properly thought through so that when the consultants are on site, the actual training, the transfer happens in a way that is efficient and effective. The purple circle at the bottom talks about performance management and monitoring of the consultant. And this area talks about when you bring a consultant on board, that again, the consultant must remain an independent party, and that you as a buyer of that service need to monitor it, need to make sure that you are getting the value out. And we always talk about, think about somebody that you hire in your own home to do some work. You don't just leave them in your house and disappear. You monitor them, you manage them, you make sure their progress is on track, and you make sure they're delivering what you are going to be paying for. The light blue circle talked about extension of contracts. Again, extending a contract is not necessarily a bad thing. However, the reason for it needs to be done in a proper way. There may be bona fide reasons for it, but let not those reasons be that we did not do proper planning, for example. And then closing and finalizing projects. Again, many problems stem from a consulting project that reaches the end, but now we have a deliverable. And how do we close out that consulting project? How do we transfer to the department? How do we use those deliverables in the way in which we intended them to use? So, again, all of these things just need to be thought through properly. The next slide, on slide 8, just shows you, for the sake of the committee and the members and the guests, what the findings were at a national level. And again, you'll notice that many of the findings we will talk about in the context of defense, we are seeing in other parts of the government as well. So it's not necessarily that this is a unique situation to the Department of Defense. And I must say, while we are on the subject, that a similar exercise to the one we conducted on the use of consultants was conducted in the United Kingdom in 2010. So the National Audit Office, our colleagues in the UK, conducted a similar exercise on their central government. And many of the findings that you'll see on this page appeared in their report as well. And so the point we want to make is that, again, these are not problems that are unique to South Africa. Some of these are universal in nature in terms of how government uses and extracts value from consulting firms. Some of the findings that we saw in respect of planning and appointment talked about needs analysis. And this, again, is when you embark on a product, on a project, have you conducted a proper cost-benefit analysis? Have you properly considered the need and the alternatives and the opportunity costs of employing a consultant? And that opportunity cost could have been appointing our own people, training our own staff, building in-house capacity. What is needed in this area is a robust process to do this, and do this in a way that is transparent, that is that creates a record of the decision, and is one that is able to stand the test of any independent person looking at it. Planning an appointment also, we found many instances of competitive procurement processes not being followed, and often there were many reasons for this across departments, ranging from emergencies and absolute needs to people who thought that they had identified only a single source for a service, when in actual fact there were many others. One of the key things at a planning perspective that we have noted is that expectations on milestones, timelines, and costs are not clearly specified up front. And this again talks to the robustness of the planning process. When planning is done correctly, when planning is done with sufficient thought, you know exactly what you are getting, when you are getting it, and how much it's going to cost you. And so that planning then informs your budgeting, it informs your cash flows, it informs all your other processes within the department. And so we clearly stress, if you look at the outcomes of the report, there's a table in our report for those who have the report handy, which shows that out of the 127 contracts that we audited as part of the scope of our audit, 86 of them across government had problems with planning and appointment. And planning is one of those areas which, if we get right, many of the other areas, issues in the other spaces will tend to sort themselves out. With regards to internal capacity, we found really two issues that occurred across departments. One is that where consultants were appointed, where permanent capacity should have been created. And again, this talks about, have we done the correct cost-benefit analysis? We had the opportunity to create the capacity for whatever reason we decided to go out to a user consultant, and as a result, we did not build that capacity internally. And then second point is where we went out to use consultants because we did not have that capacity internally as well. With regards to training and transfer, I've touched on this again. We found generally across departments that skills transfer was ineffective. That many of the reasons for going out and sourcing a contractor who has a certain skill set did not result in a transfer of, I mean, we're not unrealistic to think that the private sector is going to automatically transfer all its knowledge, but even to the point that we have planned for certain skills transfers to take place, they have not taken place. Performance management and monitoring, effective oversight and internal controls, not to exclude prior payments. And so this talks about the robustness of contract management, that you pay for what you get. You pay because of the value that you extract as a department. You pay because you are getting due value, due consideration for the money that you are giving. Lack of proper project management and monitoring. So these are disciplines, internal disciplines, administrative disciplines, which need to be strengthened. And then having cost overruns that are not motivated and improved. So again, this is a symptom of planning. If your planning is not robust enough, you'll often find yourself in a situation where you have a cost overrun which is difficult to explain because you started off on maybe the wrong assumption, or you started off on the basis of wrong planning. So it becomes very difficult to justify a cost overrun later on in the process. Which leads to the next point of extension of contract. Where we found many contracts extended due to a lack of project management and monitoring. Often, you know, these things would seem so logical. A contract is coming to an end, We know the contract is coming to an end. We should have started planning for 8 months before it came to an end. However, we find ourselves a couple of days away from the end termination date of the contract, and we have not yet gone to tender.
Thank you very much, Chef. I understand what you're trying to do here. But it's like he's giving us a lecture to how auditing is being done. I would suggest that you go straight to the Department of Defense and check what are their discoveries in terms of the usage of consultants in the department. But if we will spend a lot of time
No, we are doing it within time. I think the Office of the Auditor General has until 10 o'clock to finish their presentation. My view is that they will give us broad principles, and then when we go to the department, we'll try to locate the problems into those broad principles. Think you should go on.
Thank you very much, Chair. And to address the Honourable Member's concern, the very next slide now starts delving into the specific findings. In terms of the last block there, the orange block, again, generally we found, again, across departments, a failure to retrospectively analyse projects. So to look back and learn from the mistakes that we've made in the past. Now, the reason I wanted to just go through this again is to place some context. To the findings that are department specific and how they relate to the other departments as well. And you will notice that as we go through, many of these challenges are not unique to the department. They exist within other departments as well. And so a systemic approach is needed in order to do this. Chairperson, now on slide 9, the next slide of our presentation, we will now delve into the department specific issues. And I'll ask my colleague, Shoneel, to take us through some of the details as we move through the presentation.
Thank you. Honourable Chair, esteemed members, I will deal with the... thank you, Naeem. Honourable Chair, esteemed members, I will take you through the detailed findings to the Department of Defense. That we noted during the course of the performance order. What we had noted was the total expenditure on consultants, contractors, agencies, and outsourced services amounted to 10.4 billion rand for the period 2008-09 to the period 2010-11. And for the purposes of the performance orders, we selected 12 contracts, and the value of those 12 contracts amounted to 1.153 billion rand. And during this time, we had also noticed, the vacancy rate at the department was 10.6% for the period 9-10 to 10-11. Giving you the table below just outlines the expenditure by the department in the categories of agency and support outsourced services, consultants, and contractors. Well, what the audit findings for the department have been on the slide, we've broken it down into the consultants per contract auditors, as well as how we classified these consultants, as well as the areas where deficiencies were identified during the audit, as well as the 3 E's that were affected arising from the deficiencies identified during the course of the audit. For instance, on the first one, supplementing skills in South African Air Force, the way I will deal with this is I will talk about the classification of each of the projects as well as the 3 E's affected. The areas for deficiencies I will discuss later as they will form part of the detailed findings in the later slides. So for the first one, the supplementing skills in South African Air Force, we classified that as an agency outsourced services, and the 3 E's affected there, or the E's that were affected from the findings noted, were economy and efficiency. On the second one, clearance of unexploded ordnance, we classify that project as a consultant. And the three, and the E's effectives were again economy and efficiency. On the third one, the demilitarization of redundant ammunition, we identify that project as a consultant to the nature of the work performed. And the E's effectives affected were economy and effectiveness. On the fourth project, the use of consultants to clear audit qualifications, we classify that project as a consultant, and the E's effectives were economy. On the fifth, provision for general and skilled laborers, we classify that project as a contractor, and E's effectives were all three: economy, efficiency, and effectiveness. The next project identified was the maintenance of the Limpopo border fence, and we could classify that project as agency outsourced service, and the E effective was economy. On the seventh project, maintenance of three military hospitals, we classified that project as a contractor, and the E effective were all three again: economy, efficiency, and effectiveness. On the eighth project, cleaning services at one military hospital, we classified that project as a contractor, and the E's effective were efficiency and effectiveness. Please note that for the effectiveness of this contract, that no records were mentioned to confirm that services had been delivered. The cleaning services at the one military hospital, again, we classified it as a contractor, and the E's, or the E's that effective were affected with efficiency and effectiveness. On the ninth project, session doctors, we classified that as agency outsourced services. And in terms of that project, we noted that there were deficiencies in listed all three E's. On the 10th project, the charter of aircraft for the transportation of troops and supporting equipment to African states. Here we noted them as being the agency outsourced services. However, no deficiencies were identified during the audit of this contract. On the stock verification and asset management, we identified them, classified them as a contractor, and again, for the next project as well, establishment of new headquarters and a MIS for South African Navy, where two contracts where no deficiencies had been identified during the course of the audit. Moving on to the next slide. The next slide basically indicates variation orders. Stemming from the 12 contracts that we have collected, 4 contracts resulted in variation orders. And they specifically pertain to the clearance of unexploded ordnance, the provision of general and skilled laborers, maintenance of the Limpopo border fence, and the maintenance at the Free Military Hospital. And the key issue, a key finding in all 4 of these contracts was that no competitive tender process was followed in any of them by the department. Taking you back a few slides to, for instance, the clearance of unexploded ordnance, you will note that 2 of our focus areas, namely your planning and appointment and performance management and monitoring, were areas of deficiency were identified. And these deficiencies have resulted in extensions. For example, on your clearance of unexploded ordnance, we had deficiencies in the areas of planning and appointment, performance management, and monitoring, which then led to an extension. The second example is the provision of general and skilled laborers. Again, we had deficiencies in the planning and appointment process, as well as performance management and monitoring. So it was an issue that was common in all 4 contracts that resulted in extensions. Moving on to the detailed findings per consultant. On the first one, the supplemental skill of the South African Air Force. Here we had noted that the contract was an evergreen contract. It was entered into in 1986,
and it hasn't been renewed or reviewed by the department since. Furthermore, there was no cost-benefit analysis performed to determine the best possible benefit to the department. The second finding we had noted, Chair, I should have first alluded to the key on the bottom right of the slide. These are actions that the committee should it's actions that the committee should actually take with regards to the findings as indicated on the slide above there. For instance, on the light green block, the committee should conduct intense scrutiny of the city's plan and accountability report. On the pink shadings, the committee should ensure that activities are monitored on a quarterly basis. And on the light gray key, the committee should follow up on corrective action against action plan. Moving on to the second finding on the supplementing skills in South African Air Force, we had noted that there were deficiencies in the management and monitoring of the contract. Here we had noted that payments made to the consultants amounting to 233 million rand had not been monitored by the department, as well as prepayments amounting to approximately 37 million rand that had been made, which was in contravention of National Treasury regulations. And the third finding that was noted was that there was a lack of capacity within the department as 600 people had been employed or had been supplied by the consultant to the department to carry out functions for the Air Force. For the clearance of unexploded ordnance, here again we found that no cost-benefit analysis could be provided for the purposes of the audit, and also no evidence of monitoring and time frame being met could be provided for the purposes, again, for the audit to determine whether the department had actually monitored these consultants on a regular basis. Moving on to the demilitarization of redundant ammunition, here we have found that the project had been terminated prior to the commencement, resulting in a claim against the department by the consultant itself. Also, the department could not provide any evidence that a cost-benefit analysis, a full costing, was done prior to the appointment. And the third finding was that the department did not follow a competitive bid process when appointing this consultant. Moving then to the use of consultants to clear audit qualification, you've noted here that the department did not create internal capacity or expertise to ensure that the audit findings could be cleared in a timely manner. Also, there was not a cost-benefit analysis had not been done because the department had deemed this to be of urgent nature. Moving on to the provision of general and skilled labourers, we found that contract had not been effectively monitored by the department, as well as payments being made to the consultant without supporting documentation. The maintenance of the Limpopo border fence, here again we noted that the department had not conducted a cost-benefit analysis prior to appointing the consultant. Maintenance at the 3 military hospital, here the Surgeon General had decided that the outsourcing of the maintenance of this hospital would not continue as he expected to create internal capacity. However, at the end of the contract period, the staff recruitment had not been prioritized, resulting in the extension of that contract. Furthermore, compliance, the department had not monitored the work performed by this consultant. Moving on to the cleaning services at the 1 military hospital, again, the department had not monitored the services provided by the consultant. the department here was of the opinion that it was not their responsibility as end users, but rather the responsibility of the service center that had contracted the consulting. And lastly, the session doctor. Here again, there was no monitoring of the consultant's work by the department. Chair, moving forward, I will hand back to Naeem to take us through the recommendations proposed to the department. Thank you.
Thank you, Sonia. Honourable Chairperson, honourable members and guests, the outcome of this performance audit again, I must stress, which was not an investigation, it was a performance audit, and the objective of the performance audit is to ensure, as I said earlier, and I just don't want to sound like a broken record, but I'll say it again, that we obtain value for money from the use of consultants. Hence, the recommendations that we have made in the report are all geared towards improving for the future how we achieve the three E's of economy, efficiency, and effectiveness in our use of consultants. The first of our recommendations is that, firstly, compliance with legal frameworks, laws, regulations, and policies be enforced when we use consultants. So there are many prescripts and policies, etc., that have been developed that govern the use of external service providers, and we urge and appeal for a compliance with those prescripts. The second recommendation we have made, again, I touched on this earlier, is that the terms of reference and deliverables for all contracts are communicated to all end users. And this is to ensure that the people that we are procuring services for are themselves convinced that they require that deliverable, that output. And so when they receive the value that is coming out of the consultant, it is used in the most efficient and economical way. We've also made a recommendation that certain internal control deficiencies be addressed and that internal controls be strengthened to ensure that there is robust decision making, that there is robust consideration, and the gates through which these transactions need to go through are robust. We've also made a recommendation in the report that sufficient internal capacity be created in many respects. Now, we are realistic as well in the sense that we understand that in certain spaces consultants are needed. However, the extent to which they are needed needs to be carefully thought through, especially where we are using consultants for a core competency of a department. We feel that this is an area which requires a bit more analysis and thorough justification when we go out and use consultants versus using and building our own capacity. The planning is absolutely vital to this entire process, and our recommendation on planning probably is one of the most important ones that we are making, to say that planning for the use of an external service provider should be done in a more robust way, considering all the alternatives properly, doing the cost-benefit analyses in some detail, and considering the alternatives properly, so that when we make a decision and we go out to use the services of a consultant, we are sure that that is the absolute best decision we've made, it's the most economical decision, the most effective decision, and it's the most efficient decision that we have made. Managing and monitoring performance is perhaps the next in line in terms of order of importance of our recommendation. Truly, when we engage a service provider, let us not forget that there is an arm's length transaction, that consultant is an independent party, and that we as a department have a requirement to manage that third party and to monitor their performance and demand that they deliver the value that we expect as a department from them, and for which they are being paid. Training and transfer skills, I touched on it again, it's a common problem we've seen. Consulting services are such an important vehicle for the transfer of skills from the private sector to the public sector. However, this does not happen automatically. It really needs to be done carefully, thoughtfully, and monitored to make sure that it is happening, and that we as a customer at the end of the day of a consulting service are getting the right value that we demand from that service provider. Our last recommendation, the bottom right of the slide really, and we can't stress this enough, if we look at the scope of this audit, which started in the you know, the 2009, 2010, 2011 years, one would argue that this is water under the bridge, that this is in the past. Rightfully so, many of these contracts are still continuing today. But the important thing, I think, is what we learn out of this exercise, and that is the improvements and the recommendations we made, that we learn from the past mistakes and that we apply these in the future. So improving the robustness of planning as we move forward is important for us in terms of achieving the value for money that we require. Chair, honourable members, on page 16, we've presented a model for the members and for the guests and the department to look at. We sat down as an office and we said to ourselves, well, when it comes to using consultants, how do we get assurance that we are getting value for money? And this kind of a model is not new or unique to the AG. It's a model which is even used in the private sector. It's used across the world to say that there are three levels of assurance that need to be in place in order to make sure that we get value for money from the use of consultants. The first level of assurance is provided by management themselves. So the senior management within the department, the accounting officers and various authorities, the executive authorities, the minister and team, are the first level of assurance. And we've presented a number of recommendations to show how can this level produce that level of assurance. The second level of assurance are the various coordinating and monitoring institutions. And here we stress the importance of internal audit in ensuring that we achieve value for money from consultants. Our recommendation is that internal audit firstly follow up on management's actions to address specific findings, but importantly, conduct your own performance audits like this on the use of consultants. You don't have to wait for the Auditor General to come in to talk about performance and auditing the three E's. You can do this internally yourselves and address some of these issues up front. And we feel that this is an important assurance mechanism. And the audit committees as well. We feel the audit committee should play a big role in monitoring the implementation of the various commitments made to correct some of the issues that have been found, but importantly monitoring the spend on consultants going forward and asking some of the questions that we have asked in conducting this audit. The third level of assurance is that of those independent providers such as ourselves. We are an independent assurance provider as your external auditors. And there are various public accounts committees and oversight committees, including this committee. You know, we've set aside recommendations on what we feel is needed. But I guess the key message out of this slide is that these three levels are what is needed in order to ensure that going forward we achieve the level of assurance that we need that we are getting value for money from the use of consultants. Chairperson, I'm almost at the end of my slides here. We have recognized that there is commitment all round from the department, from the parties that we have visited. We've noted some of the commitment in the report as well in terms of action that has already been taken in respect of dealing with some of these issues and anomalies. We recognize as well that some of these contracts extend back a fair number of years and that corrective action is ongoing. But it's the commitment of all parties involved that is needed in order to address and make sure that going forward we achieve the value for money that we are so desperately seeking. I'm not going to delve into the comments that have been provided. They are contained in the report, but again it's to echo that many of them show that action has been taken in many regards, or in many cases action is in the process of being taken to address some of the deficiencies, and we're very heartened by that. Chairperson, I will end off on slide 19 of the pack, which is we also want to stress this point, that we recognize, as I said in my introduction, that this is a relationship of national importance for us as a country, and that the creation of value for us as citizens really comes from having a balanced partnership equation between the public sector and the private sector. When these two parties work together in the correct way, in a way that generates economy, efficiency, and effectiveness, enhance the value for our citizens at the end of the day. However, while the subject of this report focuses on the left-hand part of the debate, the public sector, we must not forget that the other part of the equation is equally important in terms of its own internal controls and robustness to make sure that this equation functions. And so, through the report, through our media briefings, we have made an appeal to the private sector to themselves not take advantage of weaknesses in government systems and weaknesses in internal controls when they find them. That they should rather be good corporate citizens with a good corporate conscience, that they regulate themselves in terms of their various professional bodies and take steps to stop some of the malpractices. This is an appeal that we have made, and we really feel that if we truly want to realize the common goals of economic success, that this requires an effort not just by government but by the private sector themselves in order to make sure that this equation functions in a way that delivers us value for money. Chair, that brings us to the end of our presentation as an offer. We want to thank the honourable members and yourself for the time, and we remain at your disposal to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Officer of the Auditor General. Honourable members, I want us to go back to the suggestion of Honorable Mlambo. I guess you may not ask the Auditor General as to why the contract of 1986 was open-ended. That can only be answered by the department. And you may not ask the Auditor General as to how far is that department in terms of capacitation itself, or maybe on various sections of their work. Most of the deficiencies that were mentioned here, they cut across all contracts. Lack of planning, capacity, skills transfer, lack of internal control, lack of monitoring. They cut across all the contracts. Now, what I want us to do is to go straight to the department and pick up that contract that they were supposed to present on as our case study. But meanwhile, what we can do with the Auditor General is just to ask questions of clarity. For instance, I would like to know what will constitute robust planning. So I want us to do that, and then if you agree, we can ask questions of clarity and then go straight to the department. Honorable Daniels, Honorable Michael.
Thank you, Chair, and to the Auditor General's office.
We must start by saying we agree with, we should ask whether we agree with the process or not.
Oh, Chair, yes, I do agree with the process. And first, I would also want to know whether we first deal with the Auditor General before going to the department, so that if I ask a question from the Auditor General's office, I only do that, then I will come back to the department so that we proceed with the same argument when we start with it.
No, what I'm saying is that you may not ask the Auditor General as to why the 1986 contract is open-ended. The Auditor General will not know that, but you may ask questions of clarity from the Auditor General. In terms, maybe you want to know about the efficiency, the effectiveness, and so on.
I get exactly what you're saying. All I'm asking, firstly, I agree with the process. But also, I want to clarify that if I am asking a question of clarity from the Auditor General, should I only do that for all the members? Then we go to the department and deal with the department. So that I must not mix the Auditor General with the department.
That's correct.
Okay, then. Chair, thank you. And thank you from the Auditor General for a very clear
background for auditing, government department. Now, Chair, to the Auditor General. One, seeing that defense operates in a unique environment, and also understanding that the guidelines cut across in terms of reporting and the processes thereof, I just want to clarify if these guidelines, in terms of the Auditor General, does the Auditor General see that defense can be able and may be able to do its work in terms of its guidelines so that it can be able at the end of the day to report in a manner that is required by the Auditor General? Having also alluded to the fact that it is a unique environment. Because there is somewhere in the document, in the other document, where the Auditor General was saying they could not audit because it was said that the information is what do you call it? Classified. Now, hence I'm asking this question. Do you think, in terms of your regulation of reporting, are they or can they work with the Department of Defense in that? It is a unique. Thank you, sir.
Honorable Majid.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to clarify a few things here, especially on the key challenges that were given at the beginning. I would just like to understand the problems that were noted. Is it because some of these things were not in the contract itself or in the terms of reference, or it was not clear in the contract? Say, for instance, training and transfer of skills. If that was not done, is it because it was not in the contract or it was not well clarified? Extension of contract, I would like to understand, where does the problem come in? And skills transfer was ineffective. Well, maybe with the Department of Defense it might be different. But what about interdepartmental skills transfer? This consultant goes to public works, does the same thing, from there moves to defense, does the same thing. Interdepartmental, how does it work? And the interprovincial, I mean, this person can go and do it in Mpumalanga, from there just rotate the whole of the country doing the same thing. In fact, doing, I remember at some stage one consultant even forgot to take out the footnotes. The footnotes still said fresh start. And he was delivering the same thing in Limpopo. So, how about the transfer into interprovincial, interdepartmental? I think that is a relevant question to the Auditor General. And the lack of skills. What is the problem? Is the problem if you go for consultants, is the problem because the relevant post has not been identified, meaning that it just doesn't exist? Or is it because it is there, but you can't get people to fill it because of the amount, I mean, the salary or scale or something of that nature? Or maybe it just doesn't exist altogether. And therefore warrants consultant. Well, this one is on a borderline. I don't know whether it belongs to the department or to the consultant. The maintenance of the border fence. What exactly is that? Is it a patrol or is it the fence itself?
Yes.
Fence as in maybe it was cut down and you need to, or if it's the patrol, yes, if it is the patrol, then I would have to ask the department whether they don't have capacity to patrol, they've got to go and look for consultants. And in a case where there was no contract, what does that mean? How were these people appointed? They simply, somebody picked up a phone and said, I've got a job here for you, or what actually happened. And Chairperson, it would make life very easy for me if these pages were numbered. As you can see, I'm dealing with it as if I'm a baby at crash, so it might waste time because it is not numbered. The very last question: does any of the results that you came up with warrant any process issue? Either because there was some negligence there, or there was fraud, or there was anything illegal. Thank you, Chairperson.
Also, before I come to you, I'll come to you, Honourable. We'll be Honourable Munia Sokhar, but I just wanted to put clarity on one thing. The question that Honourable Mike is asking, indeed to cut across about the maintenance of the border fence, but we will need to know from the Auditor General as to what it means to them. It might mean something to the department, but what it means to them, because it was mentioned, I think it will be relevant in that case, along those lines. Then we will go to Honorable Minier, and then go to Honorable Diale and Honorable Mukabadini. Thank you, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. As you know, my overriding concern is the consequences of the ANG contract, but I will direct those questions to the department after their presentation. Just a brief question for clarification to the Auditor General. Did you, as part of your audit, identify who in fact owns these companies and entities, and whether there was any, and if so, did you identify any conflicts of interest, and if you didn't audit that aspect, why didn't you audit it? Key to me, key for me, Chair, would to be have a very careful look at who owns these companies. Thank you.
Honourable Diale, I said in that order.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Mine is a clarity. A question of lack of internal capacity. What happens when there is internal lack of capacity? What actually is the issue? I just want a clarity. It's not a much a question. not created. What is that? What does that mean? Not created. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, sir. Close to what Honorable is saying. It's close to that one. I would like the wisdom of the Auditor General, and thanks for your presentation. On your last slide, you said must not take advantage of weaknesses in the government system. And the issue of monitoring, from your own observation, do we have those skills as a country? If no, what can the Auditor General do to actually create workshops, courses, to avoid the issue of the reality that there was no monitoring at the end of the whole consultancy period, only to be discovered at that time? What is the Auditor General Department, what can they do to really make it a point that we're not, consultants are not taking an advantage of the weaknesses? Because this issue of monitoring is really, it's cut across. It's really cut across. I just want the wisdom of the AG. Thank you.
Can we get a response from the Auditor General?
Chairperson. Chairperson, I'll do my best to respond to the questions as I've recorded them. If I do miss out, I will appeal to the members to please remind me if I've not answered anything. With respect to the Chairperson, starting with your question, on what would constitute robust planning, what are some of the things that would constitute robust planning? We have outlined certain key controls in the report itself. So those of you who have the report available to you, on page 108, right at the back, and I'm not sure if people have gone to that extent in the report, but there's on page 108, there's a table there called focus areas and key audit questions. And each of these questions, each of those areas there, those green, red, you know, turquoise, purple, blue, and orange areas, for each of them, we have outlined what exactly are we looking for when we talk about, for example, planning an appointment. And so when we talk, for example, what constitutes robust planning, what we would expect to find is whether the department analyzes, firstly, the cost effectiveness and does the cost-benefit analysis up front to say, what's better, do we create permanent capacity or do we go out to consultants? But the robustness and going through a thorough process is important to say, well, do we use consultants? Do we create the capacity? What's best for us to ensure that we ensure continuity of our service and service delivery? Other aspects to go into planning an appointment was, are we giving consideration to whether the objectives would be best achieved through the appointment of consultants or permanent staff? Other questions are we following a competitive and transparent appointment process that will not be brought into question later on? Have we instituted effective recruitment and appointment processes to limit the duration of the time in which we use the consultant? So it may very well be that at a point in time, yes, we need them. But however, have we put into place a plan to make sure that we are able to phase them down as we phase in our own people? And are we following proper contract administration? So which includes the setting of milestones, performance targets, the monitoring, as the member had spoken about earlier, making sure that roles and responsibilities are clearly set out in terms of ourselves and the consultant in terms of what they have to deliver, which includes one of those important roles, which is that they transfer skills to the department. And like that, I think I'll address one of the questions that came later on in terms of what's involved in monitoring. Because if you look again at the table talks to what are the key controls that we require to monitor. And there it's things like, are we monitoring and controlling the work of the consultant to ensure we get quality out of it? That the work performed matches that which is promised in the contract. that the deliverables we get and what is achieved, you know, is being achieved in the most efficient and cost-effective manner. Other questions include, you know, are we considering alternative options to ensure that the objectives and business needs are achieved in a timely way? And do we have the controls in place to avoid us unnecessarily extending and control you know, prolonging that contract? So those are some of the key controls that, that are important, and I'll address the members' concern a bit, you know, a bit later as we go through. On the question of that defense operates in a unique environment, and some of the guidelines cut across sectors, cut across the spheres of government, and whether defense is able to do its work, and for us to be able to report in a manner which is acceptable, we recognize that the environment in which defense operates presents certain challenges with respect to access to certain information, and those being sometimes of a classified nature. As an office, within our teams, we firstly have auditors who have the necessary classification clearance to be able to conduct audits of that nature. And some of you have engaged with some of those members from our team. In terms of can we do our work with defense and can we report effectively, we believe most truly that we can, and that we've put in place the mechanisms to allow us to do that. However, many of the findings that we have noted as well are not of a classified nature. They talk to administrative issues. They talk to general management issues. And so, despite the challenges with regards to access to certain information, certain information was not provided, not because it was classified, but because it was just simply not available. And those are some of the recommendations we put down in terms of strengthening the contract management process, making sure that things like cost-benefit analysis, which may have been subject to an informal discussion amongst management, that those things get documented. So that, for example, a contract that was entered into in 1986, when we sit here in 2013, the records that point to the decision the institution has taken are available. So that we stop these processes from becoming individual things, and we create proper records for the institution. With respect to the questions around the key challenges, and there were a number of them, so I'll try and do my best to answer them, and I'll ask Sunil to jump in as well at times. In terms of the contract management and the skills transfer, were they in contracts, or is it a case of they were in the contract and not being done? Well, it was a mixed bag. As we went through the 127 contracts we audited, there were many different aspects around skills transfer that became problematic. We often find that where it was in the contract, where the consultant has said in their contract that, you know, give us the job, give us the work, and we will make sure we train your people, we make sure we transfer skills. We often get situations where, because of the lack of capacity, the consultant is on site, doing their work, delivering value, however, there's nobody to transfer the skills to. And so, again, these things are so systemically linked. Planning, if we've got that right, we will know that when the consultant is on site, we need to make sure that we also have the people on site so that they can train them. There were definitely instances where the bodies were not in the chairs, and there were instances as well where it was in the contract and not performed as well, which again then talks about monitoring and making sure that if we're paying for 10 things, we get 10 things from them. And so that is a sort of a mixed bag there. In terms of extensions, what is the problem with an extension? I don't agree with saying that there is necessarily a problem with extending a contract. Needs definitely arise in the normal course of business where we're using a service provider for whatever reason, and we find that we need to extend it. What we are saying is let's make sure that those really are exceptions and not the norm. That we do proper planning and appointment processes to make sure that we don't extend contracts because of a lack of oversight, of a lack of monitoring, of a lack of proper planning. That we try and minimize really the extension of contracts to only those cases which are bona fide and are required. So Can we tell you that there are any companies or organizations in the world or government departments that exist without extending contracts? Most definitely not. It's a normal part of business. However, the robustness of the internal controls around it is what we are suggesting needs to be improved. With regards to the question around interdepartmental skills transfer, I think it's a very valid one. About the question as to how many times are we as government paying for the same thing that's being recycled. Certainly it's not within the scope of the audit to conduct that work. We did not follow the consultants around to see what they're delivering at various departments. However, it remains a very smart thing for us to do as government, to start communicating between us and within the defense cluster, for example, it can even start here. To say, as something as simple as we're procuring a policy or we want this sort of deliverable, has it been done before and can we get it in a smarter way? Most definitely it's a very clever thing to do. So interdepartmental cooperation is definitely an area where I think we will yield considerable benefit from. In terms of lack of skills, what is the problem? There are a number of areas in respect of the lack of skills. We firstly do not have enough bodies to place in respect of the areas. Were posts not identified? Were they not filled? So the question of is it the fact that we don't have a post identified in the structure for that specific skill set? Or that we have a post and we just haven't found the person or the body to put into that post. And again, we found a bit of a combination of both, not just within defense, but across government as well. But in certain cases, decisions were taken to say that we are not going to get the skill because we can't build it internally, it's not feasible. But the decision around that, we find often, has not been documented and captured in the right way. That the analysis around it, the cost-benefit analysis versus building your own capacity versus creating or getting a consultant was not been properly thought through. And we recognize as an office that in many cases it may not be feasible for us to create every single skill within the department. And a good example of that is certainly we don't expect government to start manufacturing its own mobile phones, for example, because the intellectual property, the skills required to do that is not feasible for us as government to recreate. So there are definitely instances where we recognize as an office where consultants bring something unique through their research, their development, the money they put into certain aspects, they bring something unique to the table. However, we must be very sure that what we are getting from them, that uniqueness, we cannot do ourselves in a cost-effective manner. And I think that's the point we're trying to make, that consideration that it is best to go to the consultants versus it is best for us to do it ourselves just needs a bit more robust planning around and documentation. The question in regards to the border fence, I'll ask Shaneel to answer in a bit. I'll just move on to the next one on whether there was when there was no contract, what does this mean? And absolutely correct, it's a concern. If we engage a service provider without any contract, most importantly for us as an AG, our interest is the state. Our interest is, are we protecting ourselves as a state from the service provider? Again, let's not forget that this is an arm's length transaction. That is an independent party. And in order to ensure that our rights are enforceable, requires a contractual relationship which is documented. And so when we don't have a contract, it becomes difficult for us as the state to enforce our rights. It becomes difficult for us to demand delivery of value. And so definitely, I think in any organization, whether it's in the public sector or private sector, entering into such a relationship or transaction without a contract is absolutely cause for concern and contrary to good governance principles and the risks in laws and regulations. With respect to the numbering of the pages, the pack that we have provided is numbered on the bottom right. I hope it's not been a printing error it's not come through. With respect respect to the question on whether any of the results warrant prosecution and was there anything illegal happening, I think one needs to reflect also on the purpose of this audit, as I said at the outside. Firstly, you know, this was not an investigation. I must make that very clear. Our focus really was on the three E's. Now, what does that mean? The requirement of a manager to do their work in a manner which is effective, efficient, and economical should be part of their responsibility. So when somebody enters into a contract or does enter into a transaction in which value is not created, we would expect the performance management processes within the department to hold that official or hold that person accountable for not performing or definitely not delivering the value that we expect of them. It may very well be that subsequent investigations conducted by the department themselves might go down to the individual level to say that, you know, there was an oversight here, that this contract went through without considering or going through due planning process. And we certainly hope and trust that the departments are looking into those matters to identify those cases where individuals have not performed their responsibilities and where those individuals have left the department, that we somehow try and hold them accountable and that there is consequence for actions that people take that are contrary to prescripts, contrary to policy, and contrary to the terms upon which you employed that individual. And we think that it's very important that accountability and consequence for people's actions be enforced. One must also consider, you know, have we paid bonuses to people who do not deliver value for money? And these are the kinds of questions we hope that the department is now starting to take our work and our results and start looking at these in a more detailed manner to say who's responsible for this and should we be holding anybody accountable for it. With regards to the question the Honourable Member had around identifying who owns these companies and entities, and have we identified any conflicts of interest, we have not within the scope of this audit gone to that level of detail to identify the owners of the countries. You will appreciate that in many cases these are consortia or companies that operate in different structures, and getting to the ownership of them would be a bit more of a detailed exercise, which again we certainly hope that the department would be in the best position to answer that, having engaged with the service providers. That said, the outcomes from this consultant report are being fed into our regularity auditing process, through which we normally do conflict of interest checks. And definitely, these contracts will form part of that conflict check in the next round of regularity auditing. With respect to the lack of internal capacity, I touched on this a bit earlier. What does this mean? Lack of capacity means that either we don't have the people right now or we have not seen the need to create that capacity internally. And the capacity issues really need to, again, I sound like a broken record here, really need to be thought through very carefully. And so the decision, especially when we outsource or co-source or bring people in to do what is a core responsibility of the department, needs to be absolutely justified and properly considered. And must stand the test of scrutiny. With respect to the question around expertise not being created, what does this mean? Again, it talks to training and development of staff. So when we hire individuals into positions, do we as a department properly capacitate them to do their job? Do we train them? Do we give them the skills? And whichever mechanism we use to do that. Whether we pair them up with a consultant and hope that their transfer happens, it needs to be thought through, it needs to be planned, so that there are proper milestones and intervention, and it happens in a very considered way. I think I touched on the question with respect to the last slide on monitoring, and what can we as an office do to help you in this journey. I think this report really is the first step. We as an office saw this as a problem across government, and we said, we are going to start by doing this firstly as a performance audit. So the first thing that we can do as an office is raise awareness. Raise awareness of the three E's, raise awareness through case studies that we present in the report of contracts that we selected for sample, of where each performance audit has shown that we have not achieved value for money. So the first step for us really is around raising awareness. The table on page 108, for example, again provides an outline of the key controls that are necessary, and we think that this is important. Moving forward, as an office, we have committed to engaging with every department continuously to share the best practices and knowledge that has come out of this report. And we would urge the department, as well as members, to reach out to us to share that knowledge. We think that this is a journey that we hope that we have started through this performance audit report, and that we'll continue through the engagement with the honourable members, with the departments themselves. Shonil, may I ask you just to address some of the questions that I have not covered?
Before that, I was not asking this question, questioning whether we are raising awareness or not, ain't you? I'm talking like a South African SBK. Do you wait until the damage is done, then you raise the awareness that that's where you went wrong? What is there in the office of the AG that can give people some training on the issue of how do you monitor? Because once we are raising awareness, damage will continue being done. It means we end until the end. We wait until at the end. So I hear you, but it doesn't really address my concern as a member.
The Honourable Member raises a good point, and I must reiterate that as an office we remain at the disposal. We remain at the disposal of any member or any department institution that requires us to do this. Now, with respect to the proactive nature of the work, it's very important again, and it again comes back to the recommendation we've put down in the report. It says, let us learn from the past and apply in the future, because we don't want to sit in a position where we come back in a couple of years' time and do another audit like this and we find issues. Hence, we've laid out the combined assurance model, which we've said, don't wait for the AG firstly to do the audit before you gain assurance around this. And we've laid out the model and said these are specific recommendations for management, for internal audit, and audit committees, for all parties involved. As far as our role in that, we remain available to all parties in that chain to provide the information, to share the research, the best practices that have come out of this, whether it's a request for a workshop, whether it's a request to share that information electronically, we remain committed to that. And we will be releasing a number of work products in a couple of months, the next couple of months, that complement this report, to share some of our learnings as well and share some of the best practices that we've released. We've also noted work that was done, good practices that have been done in other countries to tackle some of these issues. So in many cases, it's not a question that we have to start from scratch and reinvent the wheel. These problems have been tackled globally before. And a good example of that, for example, the National Audit Office has a guide on the use of consultants and how do you build the environment to use consultants. So which talks about, if you, firstly on the public sector side of the equation, how do you get your own staff ready for the arrival of consultants? Right? How do you get your own staff ready? How do you get the consultant ready for arriving in your department? Then on the other side of the equation, from the private sector, from the consultant side, how does the consultant get his or her staff ready to arrive in the public sector? And how does the consultant get the public sector staff ready for the arrival of those consultants? So it becomes a bit of a mesh like that. And those kinds of best practices is what we are absolutely willing to share. It's an output of our research and development team that we have within the office. And hence we feel that through this performance audit, we have really put together a number of pointers around areas that can be proactively monitored, and we sincerely hope that that message is taken through, that let us not wait to sit here in another couple of years' time and talk about the same issues. Let's look at what has happened in the past and apply those lessons going forward from today.
There was a presentation about the some sort of a pre-audit on the annual performance plan and the strategic plan for 2013. Am I right, Mr. Sharma?
Yes, Honorable Chair, that is correct. That relates to the policy of predetermined objectives to assist the department in presenting the performance of the year 2013, which is part of our intervention from the Office of the Audit Agenda to help the department to make sure that they are gaining lessons now. So that when we come to the audit, then we will be left of the common family that we can make. And that is a separate audit, not so much the intervention.
It's not on consultants. Are you saying that?
Yes, it's not on consultants.
But still, it's some sort of, basically, is what the honourable member would like to see.
Yes.
Okay. Yes. Honourable, we'll come to you, honourable member.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. With respect to the question on a bit of clarity on the Limpopo border fence, just to give you a little bit of background, the Department of Defense is responsible for the monitoring of our borders. However, this contract relates specifically to the border fence itself, the fence, and not the patrol. And this contract stipulated that the consultant will be employed to ensure that that fence, that electric fence, which stands for, I stand to be correct, a few hundred kilometers, that needs to be maintained by these consultants. And during the course of that contract, the consultant has become or has been liquidated. And as a result, that portion of the border had not been monitored for a period of time, resulting in possible illegal immigrants in the country. What also, in terms of this contract, the department indicated that even though they have the technicians and engineers to monitor, to actually maintain this fence, because it wasn't a core function of the defense, of the department itself, they went and contracted these consultants to maintain this fence. But this contract dealt with specifically the fence itself.
Thank you very much. I think we are going to wrap up and also take advantage of the presence of the Office of the Auditor General here when the department presents on the AMG contract. I hope you stay with us, and I'll come to you. You stay with us so that when we when the department presents that, you should also advise. Honorable Mabeda, Honorable Boyi, Honorable Isao, you will be the last batch on this matter.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Chairperson, I want to check with the Auditor General's report that on this AMG group, it was on since 1986. And I want to check with them, when was the public financial management system implemented? Number two, why did they, on a yearly basis, they are auditing the Department of Defense? Why didn't they check and see that there is non-compliance since the implementation of the public service, since the PFMA? Your public financial system. Because now, to me, it means even the Auditor General's office, it's not doing the job. And now the presentation, the facilitators, they are keep on saying that they are not investigating officers, but they lack also not seeing this coming for the quite 27 years, now it's 2013. Since this is on. Now again, who is benefiting out of this? Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Mabeda, you're talking about compliance to the Public Finance Management Act. Okay.
Can I make addition?
Okay. No, no, let's get take the edition.
Chapter 10. You see, if you look at the point of most of this atonement, some runs from 2002 to 8, and some are indicated by the AG as of no information available, which means there is no contract available. Now, on a, from time to time, we do get the comments of the AG on the finances of the department. But I've been serving in this committee for the last past 15 years now. But it's the first time that I come across this kind of information. Now, what surprises me, Chairperson, is what exactly brought this to the attention of the AG? Does it say to us that there are other things that have not been presented to us, which will come as surprises in the next coming 10 years? Or are we saying that this is the last that we see this kind of surprises?
You want to ask, was the Auditor General sleeping all these years?
For me, Chairperson, this is the reflection that the Auditor General either was hiding with the department somewhere in a hole, and every time they wanted to say, but this, the department was saying, no. And the Auditor General was keeping it aside. But now, I don't know whether it's the appointment of the tech staff or the appointment of the CFO that have brought these things up. I don't know, Jefferson. I'm traumatized.
Thank you, Honorable Boy.
Yeah. Now, Chairperson, you see, what is important and interesting, it also goes back to the comments that the Auditor General is making about the relationship between the private sector and the public sector. But you see, for some of us, we've been 20 years in government. But only 20 years in government. It's worrying, you see, because you don't know how long is the cycle of this auditing process that has taken place. Because the PFMA came in around about after 94. And these lessons that we are looking for is like, what really has provoked this type of investigation, even if it's not an investigation, but this type of reflection on the state itself. This is what we are really looking for, so that we also, public representatives, could assist in correcting the path of challenges. So it keeps on slipping up. But where is the challenge? Because also, you see, you must understand, like, if you come to issues of the border, if you come to the issues of transfer of steel, and partly what worries me is there was a lot of transition taking place within the SNDF, amalgamation of different forces. Now, you see, there's no reflection from the auditor. Those type of challenges that have happened earlier in the SNDF before it became a formidable force, it does leave some skepticism, or does raise questions, at which stage, as South Africans, are we being expected, but also as public representatives, we are being expected to monitor them, but we are not able to pin down the time frame of this particular development, and it does worry, you see. Because if it becomes too much vague, it does leave us with a lot of questions that at which stage did we as public rate monitors and in public representation miss this opportunity of being able to handpick this type of problem. Because if you deal with skills, I mean, we've been looking for how to make sure that some of them that doesn't want to be full time in the defense, how we integrate them so that they can be able to become helpful within the defense force. So this monitoring ourselves also as public representative have been on it for quite some time. Where did we miss the point? That's the question that I'm asking myself. Did the auditor general audit were we so much blinded in how we deal with the defense force over this time, over this particular period? It's a question that leads a lot of us to myself to linger at. Where did we go wrong? Did you miss to see this type of development? Because we have dealt with some of these things quite in the past, and that linkage doesn't come across. So that's why I'm also saying that partly the auditor general should be able to give us some sense of where did we go wrong, or at which stage did these developments take place that even public representatives taking their own duties have missed this particular topic. Where did we go? That's my question.
I reckon that the Auditor General's office is noting that. You see, members feel like that this is a surprise attack. Mm-hmm. Are we going to continue the surprise attack, or are we going to get this information as the normal activity of the Auditor General?
Mm-hmm.
I think that should members should be assured of that. Honorable Issa.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I think I want to raise, just to add on to our previous speakers, Honorable Chair, is the one that speaks to the PFMA. We know was introduced at a certain time. We had financial auditing taking place most of the time, until late, I mean, 3 years, 2 years. Now it's actually been improved on the performance auditing. But at least there was financial auditing taking place over the years. And it's not only the AG's office that's responsible. The first office that is informed about budgeting and expenditure and reports of various departments is the Treasury. And we should have the Treasury here, because there's a management report that goes in from the AG's office that speaks to issues of irregularity, of unauthorized spending, of matters of concern. And those matters need to be addressed by the senior management of every single department, so that the actual auditor's report may not be a qualified one. They could have dealt with it prior to it being published. But if you fail to submit it according to deadlines, it will be a qualified report or matters of emphasis. Now, I'd like to know, if there were so many serious matters of emphasis, where are those management reports and issues that were not raised with the committee, or at least with SCOPA? I mean, a number of these issues we didn't know. The first time I'm seeing a detailed SCOPA report in the portfolio committee. I haven't seen such a report in front of me before. So it seems that the portfolio committee is a committee that receives the least information. And I've got a concern about that, that we are responsible for oversight, that we have to know about issues. And there are just many things that have just passed us for many years. So I'd just like to know from the AG's office, in terms of all these issues that have developed, and if the audit committee was a problem, was a shared audit committee considered that was quite more effective in other departments, but was not effective in this department? If there were issues of internal controls and risk management, were all those plans in place and signed off? And what intervention actually took place from Treasury side, not the AG's office, from Treasury side, because Treasury actually offers training to all the departments in terms of financial controls. There are regular courses being conducted by Treasury. What has happened over the years, and did they actually intervene? Did they make a change to it? And I think this is what we need to ask, is not of the AG's office only, but more so of Treasury, which has the overarching responsibility of ensuring that the budget is properly spent and that we get decent reports on. Thank you.
Chair, I just think I should place on the record in defense of the AG's office that the question of the AMG contract has been, as far as I'm aware, in every Auditor General's report at least since 2008-2009. It is the subject of a huge board of inquiry conducted by the South African Air Force. What we're talking about here is not a failure of the Auditor General, it's not a failure of the National Treasury, and it's not a failure of the department, it's a failure of Parliament. We knew about this, we did not look into it. It's a failure of this committee, the Joint Standing Committee, and SCOPE.
First of all, Chair, thank you very much. I think Honorable Maynard should be clear that it is his failure. You shouldn't say it's a failure of this committee. Let's correct him on that one, comrade.
Yeah, but that topic is out of place now. The topic is out of order. Okay. Can we then, while the Auditor General is here, you'll answer the question and we'll ask the department to present on the AMG. I'll talk to it when we come to it. The Secretary of Defense would like to see on your presentation. Auditor General.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair. With respect to the question of did we miss this, were we blind to this, I can most certainly say no, we were not. With respect to maybe the shock that many members are seeing, this kind of reporting, keep in mind that this is not the first time we've reported on this. Similar performance audits were conducted in 1996 and 2002. And I refer to page 15 of the detailed report, which talks at a very high level of the outcomes of those reports. And I'm just going to read it for the benefit of the members who don't have it in front of them. Performance audits on the use of consultants by government were conducted in both 1996 and 2002. The main findings of those reports related to the acquisition and appointment processes, the monitoring and control of consultants, the department's responsibility to create environments conducive for consultants to work effectively, and the implementation of the principles. So, honourable members, honourable chair, it's not a new first-time message that we're putting on the table. It's a concern that has been raised by us in performance audits many times before, and it's a concern which has been raised in our annual reports in maybe different forms to the way in which it's packaged here. Through our annual reporting, we report regularly on fruitless and wasteful expenditure where we find it. We report on issues of supply chain management deviation. We report on HR management issues. We report on deficiencies in respect of performance management, performance information. So no doubt, it's not the first time that we as an AG are reporting on concerns such as this. Yes, the manner in which it's packaged might be a little different, but it's definitely something the AG has raised on a number of occasions before. With respect to the question around does our annual auditing process take into account these issues going forward, part of the processes within the AG is every time we do a performance audit, every time we conduct such an engagement, we augment our annual procedures to include elements of this kind of examination. You will appreciate that an audit such as this as well takes significant amount of resources and time to put together. This audit, for example, started over 2 years ago, and it talks to the requirement, the resources that are required to conduct an audit like this. Hence, we don't conduct this audit every year. We did it in 96, we did it in 2002, and we're doing it now in 2010 to the 2013 year. That said, the lessons from it are being drawn into the annual financial auditing process. With respect to the question around where the management reports are, I think the AG, for example, here and share with us, has in its annual report report reported on issues of irregular and fruitless and wasteful expenditure, and we have reported previously on issues surrounding some of the contracts that are in this report. Musa, do you want to add anything to that?
Thank you. Honorable Chair, I'd like to reiterate what my colleague Martin has alluded to previously, that there is a combined assurance model which ensures that these issues do receive attention. On one hand, there is the management. On the other hand, then there is the oversight bodies, including the committees, which also have to take necessary part in ensuring that sufficient attention is paid to this. To come to the question of PFMA, since the inception of that act, the department has been reporting in terms of that act. In terms of that act, the irregular expenditures, the fruitless and wasteful expenditures must be disclosed in the financial statement, in the annual report, and they have been disclosed. If you take any annual report, you will see that that is disclosed in the appropriate section. For our part, as the Auditor General, we have always included in our report, audit report, our findings in the audit of those matters, as one of the members has alluded to that one. I remember specifically, for example, for the year ended March 2010, we were asked by the portfolio committee to supply details of the of the irregular expenditures that we had reported on in that year. We did duly send the list of those findings that we have made, and that did include this conduct, energy conduct. Thank you.
Now, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Auditor General. The Auditor General says they have not been sleeping. Mr. Menea has just declared that he has been sleeping.
Well,
can
I would use the plural.
Can we then go to the department, and I think you are around with us so that you should give guidance, the department to give us a presentation on the AMG contract. My advice to the SecDef is that in your presentation, please try to address also the recommendations of the Auditor General. If you have done something about it, it should be indicated. It should be indicated. Remember, Honorable Members, the Auditor General was saying that the use of consultants is not forbidden. We agree, as long as it is used within the context of the three economy, efficiency, and effectiveness. I guess that's the basis from which management will move, but the basis from which this committee will move towards the three E's will start from compliance to legislation. And monitor. Okay. That's a management issue.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. I think I've noted that you would like us to focus our presentation on the AMG contract. Because I think the Auditor General has presented the findings that they had when they did that performance contract on consultants. With your permission, I would just like to make some few remarks, I think, concerning the key challenges as reflected by the Auditor General at our general response to the AMG contract. We have submitted our presentation in this format here. We will table it to the committee as read. We will not present it. those key challenges across the departments, I would just indicate that we really concur in many, many parts of that report with the findings of the Auditor General. We acknowledge various weaknesses that have been identified by the Auditor General, and we provide our corrective measures as to what we're going to do in order to ensure that we strengthen those businesses. We look at this report more as a very useful tool for continuous improvement within the Department of Defense in ensuring compliance specifically in this regard with the PFMA district. But as we were noting generally, for instance, I will just use one contract or the other to make our general statement. If you take the border contract, for instance, you will find that it said that the cost-benefit analysis was not done. And that cuts across almost all the contracts that are being captured here, that as part of our planning, we did not do cost-benefit analysis before engaging on that contract. What we accept that we have now made it part of the policy that before we get to any contract, part of the planning must have cost-benefit analysis. But I would like to say to the honorable members, it does not necessarily mean that we just went into the contract without doing some kind of analysis, whether are we going to in-source or outsource these things. For instance, when it comes to the border patrol industry, and this also talks to Honorable Daniel's point that defense is a unique department that functions not similarly, not exactly the same as other departments. It was at a time when the Parliament has said that the defense force is too large, it must be reduced, and the budget must be cut. As you know, we're supposed to be reducing members from 84,000 down to 73,000, and the Treasury has even given us a schedule that he wants to see those numbers. 10,000 soldiers must be cut off the Department of Defense in the next 3 years. It's a law. Comes from Treasury. That included that the engineering capability that we have, engineering information in the Army, that was maintaining the border, had to be cut from 150 down to 20-30 people. We couldn't maintain the border without that capacity. The Auditor General will come to you and say, you have the internal capacity. But when I say it's unique, it's because we really, the internal capacity has just been taken away from us. And another discussion we're having is that most of the time I'm scared that it is Auditor General, they're here to present themselves. But when they come to us, they send consultants to come and monitor us on the use of consultants who have no idea what's going on. When we then come in and say, no, we can't have this consultant, I mean, that we can't have this capability now because it has been taken away, we've just cut down that formation. I mean, no longer has the engineering formation that maintains the fence. Did we do analysis? Maybe might not be cost-benefit analysis. What the general wants to see, formal, robust cost-benefit analysis. What we did, though, was cost comparison analysis. And when we did that cost comparison analysis, to deploy additional troops to maintain the border in terms of the electricity capacity of it, in terms of vegetation, in other words, somebody must be there removing the weeds and cutting down. In terms of storm damages management, with the peaks and potholes must be there. Bodies must be there. And for the dark panel, tie up whatever is loose on the fence. Somebody must put bodies there. When we compared that, we found that if we were to do that over that stretch of 140 kilometers border with the stretch that we focus on in Zimbabwe in particular, it was going to cost us to give this to the contractors 3.65
communities do that comparison. And we found that rather than getting 24 million into the maintenance of the fence, we're going to go with. So this is what we mean when we say it's a unique animal. And really, when we make these statements to say the department has internal capacity, they should have engaged the consultants, they're wasting money, and they should do it themselves, it's not 100% true. And then even when we look at the extension of contracts, once you say that the extension of contracts, the contract of the Senate, the contract of the Senate, the question brings you in that something is wrong, somebody did something wrong. Let's go and look at the conflict of interest. Somebody must be involved in corruption here. The extension of contracts is actually normal within the PFMS, within the treasury regulation, as long as it's not more than 10% of the original contract. So members shouldn't, or maybe public, when they check it up there, should not come up and feel like the extension of contract meant that they did something wrong. And of course, the reason that although this contract in particular, like what I want to step that has been extended for 9 months, it was never extended, the contractor was never paid, never extended, never paid, because it has been indicated he went bankrupt himself. You can see the amount of work you have to do to maintain that fence, it was electric and the normal manual fence, the normal electric fence, and the normal storm damages and storm damage control and so forth. I mean, obviously the contractor couldn't keep up and went bankrupt. When you look at the internal capacity not created, just to highlight that sometimes there might be some misunderstanding. For instance, that will be raised when you talk about that contract of the contract related to the KPMG for the hearing of the Auditor General's findings. That's supposed to be for internal capacity, and that there was no transfer of skills. It's because at that time, as the Department of Defense, we were using the Inspector General. Remember, the Department of Defense has this uniqueness. We do have a very large, well-resourced Inspector General to ensure compliance with the Defense Act. And it was sort of double dealing as it were, because it was ensuring compliance with the Defense Act and ensuring compliance with the TFMA. We didn't have an internal audit unit. Now we do have an internal audit executive that has been appointed as of April this year at the level of the DDG to look specifically into this issue. But the capacity was there. And there was transfer of skills by the KPMG to the IG capacity. And that transfer of skills actually led to this department for the financial year 11-12 to have unqualified audit for by the auditors. So you can't say there was no transfer of skills and we had no benefit out of it. Because of that particular consultant KPMG making sure that all the adverse findings of the Auditor General are being addressed properly, we can now, I think as this Parliament, you can now actually take credit that for the first time this Department of Defense had unqualified audit, which it hadn't had a good Auditor General since the days of the 80s and the 90s, that look as far back as all that, they couldn't find any unqualified audit of the Department of Defense. Even when I went to the United States to do the benchmarking studies there, I was told at the White House that all other agencies in the Department of Defense are now being audited. Department of Defense in the United States is unauditable. They hope that it will be auditable in 2015 and get first in audit in 2018. We are more advanced even than the United States Department of Defense in terms of financial management, general controls, producing auditable books, not only auditable, but unqualified audit. So skills were transferred. Results did show, but when you read the report here, it says it was a waste of money. From that report. I think then, in conclusion,
just of my general remarks is that, yes, we realize that we have to do a lot of work to improve, and we will always come to the committee, I think, any time when we're invited to do so, and making those full disclosures in terms of our strengths as well as our weaknesses, and highlighting, asking actually for help to increase the capacity that we have in the Department of Defense presently. I think we will need proper resources in order to be able to ensure compliance, full compliance with the PFMA. Otherwise, then, as I indicated, we present this presentation to the board of sponsors and take it as read. I will then address now the AMG contract, contract in detail. It was a contract that was engaged upon at the time, I think, when there were different structures and formations in the Department of Defense. AMSCO at that time was, Genève, I should say, was part of AMSCO. And AMSCO, as a state owned entity, had both the contracting portfolio as well as the manufacturing, arms manufacturing portfolio. And as a result, the AMSCO, as it were, was almost like an extension of the Department of Defense. And this contract then, when the manufacturing arm was removed, this contract, the AMG, went with the NEL into the arms of the manufacturing. The contract itself is about the maintenance of the South African Air Force military aircraft, both for transport and the fighter planes that we have. It is not, when we call it AMG, it's really subcontracted. AMG is subcontracted, Danel has subcontracted AMG. And started, as we have indicated, in the mid-80s. It is the AMG itself is that private entity contracted by the DNL specifically for the maintenance of the South African Air Force military aircraft, maintenance and repairs for South Africa, and they have done an excellent job. This AMG involves really specialized, highly skilled technology and technical capabilities. It's really involving workers of about 500 workers, some of them highly skilled and specialized, down to what you can say low skilled, generic kind of work, which would be maintaining your warehouses, workshop as a generic low-speed work. And it is mostly, especially in the high-speed component of the workforce, your elderly white male workforce, more than 50 or some of them up to the 60-year-old staff. It is true, there has not been any transfer of skills. As I said, we're talking about highly specialized skills here to the South African Air Force. So what the Auditor General is saying there is true, and it's been a concern with us. I think one question I find difficult to answer as an accounting officer, which one has accepted, is why did we let this contract continue for the last 20 years without ensuring that it is compliant with the PFMA? And I go back to the Air Force, I try to find out what has been going on. The response I'm getting from the management there is that the contract started before the PFMA. When the PFMA came in, it was taken as a contract that that is operated by part of the state, it was taken as an internal capability, because the DNL is a state-owned entity as such. But since it is a state-owned entity, rendering this capability to a state department, then it is not an outsourced capability, it is an insourced capability. But needless to say, that view was actually not correct. So, as soon as the Auditor General came up, raised this, I think they have indicated whether 2009-2010, we embarked upon the action program to regularize the contract. We look at the contract that was signed, which said that if you have to terminate it, you have to give it 12 months' notice from the date of the anniversary of the contract. And whenever that anniversary contract then came in, whether it was 2011, 2012, we then gave those 12 months to say in the next coming 12 months, this contract will be terminated and a new arrangement will be made. As to whether, when the cost-benefit analysis was now done, to say if we terminate this, do we then go on open tender and let everybody tender for the work of the maintenance and repairs of the aircraft? Because it might be DNL, it might be AMG, it might be South African Airways Technical Services, it might be so and so, it might be so and so. Or do we build this capacity in house? As a department of defense. The Military Command Council really vigorously debated this issue. If I can say that, I think the former chief of the South African Air Force felt very strongly that it takes a long time, that is General Tafian, felt very strongly that it takes a long time to develop these skills and capabilities. Department of Defense will never be able to develop these skills in-house, and if it did, be so expensive, but these people are highly sought after and they will be very hard to manage their remunerations and their salaries. Something I can, as a medical doctor, I can relate to. I'm having problems maintaining surgeons at one military hospital. They come and go. I end up having to let them run resources. It's right across the department, I mean, rather across the government. We all know how difficult it is. I think you can maintain Director General even if you don't pay them enough, because but it was a challenge even at the time when this decision was taken. And all of these issues were raised, by the way, I'm tempting to the honorable committee now, because the committee, the chairman asked me to put everything on the table today. And I'm putting all the pain on the table. And really seeking some help to help, because even if you ask whether now that we know better, do we have a solution to these problems, I will say not all these problems. We really do not have all the solutions to this problem. But there is no doubt in our mind, after having debated the issue, that this capacity needs to be built inside the Department of Defense. Simply because even when we are in deployment, and today we are deployed in Sudan, in DRC, even when we are in deployment, we need to take this capability with us. Because right now it means that if we have an aircraft develop a problem in the DRC or anywhere, we would have to go to the international market. Say, please come and help us, because sometimes in terms of employment, labor relations, we do not have contractual commitment to say, you employee of AMG are going to leave the Centurion today and I'm taking you to Darfur, Sudan, going to fix an aircraft there. So the Chief of the Defense Force feels very strong that this is a capability that we need to have in China. So the condonement of this contract as illegal is now done with the approval of Treasury, that let's condone the contract. And the Auditor General will note it as such, as a matter of emphasis, adverse finding, irregular contract, and condoned by the relevant authorities for condoning such a contract. But that condonement only happens, it has happened, I think, for the financial year 11-12, but for this financial year, the condonement is going to, what the general has stated clearly, that it must be based on their plan. What are you going to do to regularize this contract? That's what the Water General wants to see in our financial year 11, in 2030. What are you going to do with this contract? And we would like to say to the Water General that that contract ended March 21st, 2013, and we entered into a service level agreement with PNL as a transitional arrangement. That's where we are right now. We are in a transitional, we're in discussions for a transitional contract of another 12 months, starting the 1st of April. And that those discussions are at a very sensitive stage. As the members of the committee will understand, we are now dealing with about 500 employees who have been on contract for many, many years and who have delivered excellent services as a contract to maintain the safety of the South African Air Force aircraft. That transitional arrangement we have now to take into consideration not only the existing 500 workers, but also other imperatives that we are required to look after as a department in terms of the labor laws, applicable labor laws. That include equity, labor equity, transformation, that now when we build the capacity inside the South African Air Force, that capacity will have to live up to appropriate representativity of the demographics of the country. So these are all the challenges that we are facing as a Department of Defense. And as I said, those negotiations are at a critical stage, but they amount to a plan whereby the South African Air Force, having done now this time the auditors have done appropriate cost benefits fully flexed, not cost comparison analysis. But having done appropriate cost benefit analysis, identified what we call specialized care skills within the contract itself, or specialized critical skills, I think that's what the South African Air Force is calling it. Specialized critical skills that we will need to retain as of 1st of April. And then the other, that is non-critical, non-death skills that rest in the AMG today, we have to be retrenched. The cost of retrenchment is estimated, again, estimated, we say, at maybe 185 million. Care skills to be retained estimated at 139 workers. Capability required when the department is running full force to its own internal capability estimated at about 250. I know sometimes you say 200, but I think 250 becomes more like. So that's where we are. Come 1st of April, we will be running on a new 12-month contract, properly processed as a transitional arrangement. And come 1st of April 2014, then the Air Force should have its own internal capability to maintain its own aircraft and PEPs. Thank you very much.
Allow me to speak on this issue, seeing that my leader of my party in parliament was once a minister in this department, and this whole mess up apparently happened under his watch.
You want to recuse yourself? Conflict of interest.
Okay. Thank you very much. Secretary,
I think your presentation was very helpful. You touched on the issues that we expected you to touch on, and that would make it very simple for members, and also I hope it will save our time. Honorable members, do you have anything to say? Honorable Menier, you've been waiting for this. The moment has come. Honorable Mango, Honorable Daniel, Honorable Boy, in that order.
Can I proceed, sir? Thank you, Chair, and thank you to the Secretary of Defense for his presentation. The Chair is absolutely correct. I mean, we are concerned about the consequences of the termination of the AMG contract. Chair, let me say at the outset, the overriding concern is the consequences of the termination of the contract for the capability of the South African Air Force. At every Air Force base that we visited during our oversight week, we were told by squadron commanders and Air Force base commanders that the termination of the AMG contract could, and I emphasize the term could, have catastrophic consequences for the South African Air Force and essentially, and put simply, result in the grounding of certain squadrons within the South African Air Force. So I want to emphasize that my overriding concern here is the consequences of the termination of the contract for the capability of the South African Air Force. So my first question, will there be any short, or what is your assessment of the consequences of the termination of the contract on the operational capabilities of the South African Air Force? That's the first question. The second question is, if I understand your transitional arrangement correctly, you will retain 139 members or former members of the AMG who have specialized scarce skills, and then they will be required in a period of 12 months to, as it were, impart their skills. The question is, given the fact that those members have built up those skills over maybe 20 years or more, and given the fact that there are significant vacancies in respect of technicians in the Air Force, who are they going to hand over their skills to? That's the second question. The third question, Chair, is it seems to me that what we are not addressing here is the structural problem which gave rise to the AMG contract as long ago as 1986. And the structural problem appears to be this. And the structural problem has persisted for 20 years or more. But the Department of Defense is not able to pay, and you concede this in your document, competitive salaries to technicians in the South African Air Force. Unless that is addressed, the problem is going to persist for another 20 years. That is my assessment. I would be interested in your comment on that. That shares the AMG contract. I'd just like to move then to the whole question of the border fence. Now, in 2009, I visited the fence in question, and I remember that there was a section of the fence which I literally opened like a door, walked through the fence, over the river, and did an interview on the state of border safeguarding in Zimbabwe. The fence was in disrepair. Given the Secretary of Defense's presentation that A, the contract to maintain the fence has now lapsed, and that the Defense Force are in fact not maintaining the defense, not maintaining the fence, who is maintaining the fence, and what is the current state of that fence? Then lastly, on the Sanibo contract, which has to do with the defense equipment, that contract, I understand, is in fact a part of the National Industrial Participation Program in the arms deal. It's a failed project under the DTI's National Industrial Participation Program. And Sanibo was in fact a consortium. My question to you is, who was the DG that signed the contract, and who were the owners of the B component of the consortium called Autumn Star Trading 466? Thank you, Chair.
Look, honorable members, we must, in our response, we must remember that the Secretary of Defense gave us a presentation as to what is being done now at the transitional period. We agree that we need a retention of scarce skills, and but the question that we should also ask is that is there compliance to legislation and regulation? I think that is what we should more effort on. All other things, I think they've become water under the bridge. Honorable Mwango?
Well, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Part of what I wanted to actually add has actually been covered by the speaker before me. However, I do want to raise my concern on the length of the period, the transitional contract, of the transitional contract, whether this, in fact, the Secretary of Defense thinks that it would be adequate to deal with the issues of actually getting the FAAF ready to actually take over the kind of functions that the AMG contract has actually been doing over the years. Because I'm looking and taking from what you said, that these guys have actually been doing a very good job, and it's actually a highly specialized kind of service that they were doing. Whether 12 months will actually be adequate to prepare the SA and the SAS to actually take over that kind of function.
Yes, thank you, Chair.
got a number of questions, but all of them talk to the AMG predominantly. And let me also say, with the other contracts, or whether it's contracts or all those people who are outsourced services that the department is using, but also this will also go with to the AG. I think it's something that I forget to. We are talking, we are coming up with all these measures that we're going to be putting in place in order to correct the wrongs that we're doing. But I'm not hearing anyone talking of recourse. Recourse. Who is not doing his or her job, what happens to that person? Maybe it's about time that we introduce that as government. They're given a responsibility to do a job, they're not doing it, what do we do about you? Because they're costing government, that's taxpayers' money, then you're costing masses of the people out there. Now we need to be talking recourse. Going back to the AMG, the DEFSEC, the chief of the SAS, for 27 years. Of course, we were told that pre-1994 or post-1994, during the new dispensation, that we're being told that things were not done. Yes, they were not done, but we're looking into what we'll be doing now and on. But, Chair, we cannot just say, yes, it's water under the bridge. Now, this is what we're going to do. I think as this committee, we still need a full report. And by the way, the SAF, AF is still owing this committee a report on the efforts, all the challenges that are there, and every other thing that is happening there. We still need a full report. How did this contract stay on? One, as the Honorable Member has alluded earlier, who are the beneficiaries? Of course, we heard that Daniel was the middleman because the contract was subcontracted to AMG. Who are the actual beneficiaries? Let's get down to it. Who are the beneficiaries? What are the levels of these guilds that are with AMG? The demographics of the people who are giving a service to the Air Force through AMG. In a not so distant past, we were told by the Board of Arms Corps that Dinel was non-compliant in a number of issues. I'm not going to be dealing with those now. But with that in mind, that the Board of Arms Corps talked to the non-compliance of Dinel, and seeing in this report that we will still be dealing with Dinel, has the department with Arms Corps or Arms Corps Board dealt with those issues then that the Board of Arms Corps was talking to? As we go through with this retention contractor that we'll be dealing with. Of course, we were told that we did not enjoy any transfer of skills. Meaning, for 27 years, the department has been a cash cow for whoever. That we have not been told as yet who has been a beneficiary out of all of this. Also, Chair, the death sentence that alluded to the fact that there are labor issues and labor laws that are indication as to retrenchment. Now, how is that the business of the department? You sign a contract with the private company, how it hires people, how it deals with people in terms of labor laws, pensions, and all other things. How then does the department become part of that? When do we pay AMG monthly and for the duration of the contract? Now, how is this? How does this become your problem? What happens with AMG? You sign the contract, you terminate the contract within the ambit of the law. How is then it becomes a problem? What happens then? Last two chains. We have seen in the SANDF, more especially in the area where we put money to train members of the SANDF, once they acquire skills, out they go. Now we have forever and over talked to the question of the contract that these members are signing. As this committee, we would like for the department to make sure that between itself, whether through GNL or with the AMG, as they are going to retain 139 members of these highly scarce skills, that those contracts should be adhered to. And they should be tight enough that at the end of the day, we get the benefits out of those contracts, the intended outcomes out of those contracts. But also, we know that we've got patriotic members of the SANDF who would not just, after they've been imparted skills, leave the department. Find them, train them, skills must be imparted, so that they can remain in the department. Because we know, due to a question of scarcity of skills, but also resources, as the deputy has said, that we are unable to pay salaries that are equitable, or rather, that the private sector is paying out there. Can we then be able to deal with these contracts and look for the people that we know that they have the interest of this country at heart? Lastly, share the comment. That it is worrying what we saw on oversight. And by way of correction, not all the effort bases where we went for oversight, we were told that the cancellation of this contract could. That's not up to, we were told, in other bases by them. But it is worrisome to see the state of affairs within the SANDF, most specifically the airport bases that we went to. That if we think as a country that by cutting the budget of the SANDF, and because we are on peacetime and therefore we do not need the capabilities that we are supposed to be having as a country, whilst we are fulfilling as a country through the SANDF our international obligations, then we've got another thing coming. Because no one will tell us that they are attacking when they are taken. That if we do not need the SANDF as a country, then let's pack our bags and go home. Then it means we don't need the SANDF. Because until that we realize that we need to put resources into the SANDF so that we can maintain the capability, not for aggression purposes, but for defending in terms of the mandate of the defense that is prescribed by the Constitution, we need to be doing that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Daniels. Honorable Nyango.
we must get a younger person to retrieve this place for you, because I see you are going to be in danger very soon. Maybe somebody must get to retrieve this. Get under the table. That is what we want to avoid. We don't want to be held liable. Just a clarity, Honorable Daniels. You say who is owing who a report?
It's the South African SAF.
Is owing which? This committee?
Yes.
Now, maybe you should check our records, then that report should be forthcoming. Honorable Wayne?
They will check us for the opportunity. And thank you, Chair, for the report.
Welcome back.
No.
Where are you? Welcome back from
there. We are dealing with the perception. Perception too. We need to account for 10.4 billion. This is what the total expenditure on consultants. That's what is being said by the organization. How are you going to do that? Because I was trying to calculate what you have presented. The figures are not getting proper for me. I know I'm not a good mathematician. But can you just help us? In the public eye, the SANDF is doing that, yes. The collapsing structure doesn't have capacity. So consultants are the most people that are being used in the SANDF. So this 10.4 billion is like glaring. And I'm trying to struggle to explain myself. When I look at your presentation, I've not been able to come closer to that figure. How do we get closer to that figure, and how do we answer? So sometimes we might talk amongst ourselves, but the public outside thinks that the SANDF is collapsing because of this big, huge figure that has been presented by the Auditor General. That we are just using consultants, and you are also a consultant. There's a step there. I just check properly. So for me, that is the first question. But you know what you are saying. There's a challenge with current funding, even in dealing with the AMG. That's what you are saying on page 6. At both current funding level as well as the limitations of current dispensation. That's on page 6. For me, it's as doing all these other plans, how do you think we'll be able to deal with this particular force? Resources are needed. And if your current funding structure is not able to meet those challenges that are presenting, what are you going to do? I haven't seen that. Now, one of the other allegations made by the AG is making general statements like politicians. And I'm struggling to find my feet within the SANDF. Because this is where we're supposed to focus. In one of their documents, they say compliance with legal framework, laws, regulations, and policies. And I'm trying to get down to you that which laws have you violated. If you could give me an answer, because I was struggling to get it in your report. Which laws do you think you have violated? Maybe I can get it from you. So that we can know whether that's where consequences would sometimes be called for that. Which laws are we talking about that we have violated? Because if you give me page 9, which says that you then, as it was, operated under a different governance regime. That's what you are saying. So I'm just trying to struggle and see where do I fit you in terms of the defense, in terms of what the Auditor General is presenting. Is it a general statement or is it? In terms of your report, is it there that you feel that the law here was totally violated? We do know the experiences of how General Hafiani has done this type of presentation relevant to what the to what the Honourable is saying, that in terms of the human capacity of this AMG and the many years that goes with it, what is it that you are going to do? Will it carry along some transformative, I mean, like implementation, where we make sure that the personnel involved is not narrowly or historically the personnel that has always been in the AMG? Well, this thing of scarce skills and the threat that always comes with it would tell you that it has been happening for the past 20 years. It's always been presented to us that this is a threat, everybody is in the country. But there's no evolution of where skills are being introduced to be able to bring changes within the institution. How do you want to do that? And how confident are you?
Thank you, Honorable.
Thank you, Chair. First, my apology for being late. This is only one iron in the fire. Unfortunately, I have many. I beg your pardon?
What? On the time.
On the time.
But because it seems you know where Mr. Boyu has, where we do not know.
Maybe I should have a private talk with him, Chairperson. But you will see the difference is that I'm asking questions, I'm not going to deliver a speech. So maybe it's better if members come late, you know, because I don't deliver speeches. Chairperson, no, bear with me if it has been mentioned. I would like to hear it again. I refer to the AMG contract. Firstly, I want to know on the feasibility study, if it's possible that we can have a copy of that, because we see there was a feasibility study, but I would like to ensure myself about the aspects of it. And then my question, Chairperson, is on page 7, it says notice of termination has been given with closure. Oh, sorry, the second one, the DOD has finalized alternative ways to close the gap. Now, Chairperson, I want to know, something doesn't make sense to me. We had about 520 employees. Now we have 139. Now, if we say that we can still close the gap with 139 employees, do you want to tell me the others were actually not needed? It doesn't make sense. If the job can be done with 139, why was it always been done with 520? Or is it a matter of we are scaling so down because we cannot afford it? And that's not to blame on the SANDF. We know that we have a shortage of money. But that creates the impression with me that we are cutting so much on our sources that we are not fully operational. And I would like to know, in this gap, are we still fully operational in that specific aspect, using 139 of the employees now? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable. Can you get a response from divided to make a board?
No, Chair, you answered me when you made your comment about the compliance and regulation. But what is touching me is, as a country, I've got the impression now that we don't believe that people do take pension, they go on pension. We believe that it's at infinity, my person will always be with us. Always be. I'm not talking about people being retrenched or whatever, but as I've been listening, I'm struck by the fact that we don't want to accept the fact that people go to pension. How do they impact knowledge while they're still working? Irregardless of whether they've done the job or not done the job, whether they were compliant or not, I'm getting the impression that people just do as they want until the pension comes. And while some of us are crying that so many people will be retrenched, at the end of the day, these people are going to go on pension. What are they leaving behind? Nobody is going to die here and then to the end of the world with that person still working there. I'm getting the impression that we are far from being serious about really grooming the young generation and the young people coming in, we hold on to the old jacket until the jacket just tells you, I'm no longer fitting your body. I don't know really. I'm getting that impression, and I'm sorry if I'm getting a wrong impression, and it's hurting me that you are really not doing anything to accept the fact that a person gets old and a person must move. But what is he or she leaving behind? That's why I was saying the chair covered me when he talked of compliance and the internal skills and stuff like that. Right? We aren't doing our job. Thank you.
Like that, the stuff that you are shedding, that's what they want to know. Is it bloated? Is it redundant? Or what terminology are we going to use?
Now I'll have to be careful there.
The mic is not on.
The mic. Switch off all of the mic.
Pension is not a bad idea.
Yeah. To take off the record. Thank you very much for the honorable member. I will be asking Commander General Masters to give some details to the questions asked. General Masters, please, if you can prepare there while I answer the other questions on the consequences of the termination of the contract, because I know you have been very much involved in that. The South African Air Force assessment for the termination of this contract, cutting down from 500 to 189 because the others were redundant and we didn't need them. 12 months is adequate age to ensure conserving of skills without endangering the safety. And the structural problem that necessitated AMG unable to pay competitive prices, how is the South African Air Force to be responding to that? And then after you have answered, maybe I might come back to add, but let me cover the other questions then. The question of the maintenance of the border fence is a big challenge to us. It has not been resolved. It involves different departments. And it is true that the Department of Defense is not responsible for the maintenance of the fence, border fence. We should be having border fence right across South Africa, all along the length and breadth of our borders. I think it's about 3,000 miles or whatever. It is not the responsibility of the Department of Defense to go now and erect that fence and then maintain it. The government itself, on our intergovernmental forum, has this issue has not been resolved. It's a facility, yes, the Department of Public Works, therefore, is responsible for public facilities. It is the Department of Agriculture must ensure that we don't have the crossover of foot and mouth diseases or other animal diseases, therefore must have the border between one country to another to ensure that foot and mouth disease does not cross from neighboring countries into South Africa. So and they do take responsibility as the Department of Agriculture if they identify risk of cross-border migration of foot and mouth disease to erect and maintain the fence. And then you come to us as the Department of Defense now, who have to ensure that once the fence is erected, nobody crosses that fence. That's what Border Patrol is all about, that nobody crosses the line. That's our responsibility. If somebody crosses the line, then we have to take necessary action. That's how the Department of Defense understands our role in the border. But of course, we do have up to limited capability that if we are patrolling the border, we see a hole was created last night, we use our propaganda banner to close that hole. Really up to a limited aspect as part of our standard operating procedure, we do budget for it, but these are all minor repairs that we will do, and minor maintenance that we think we do as part of patrolling. But we are still debating within the border management agency, within the interdepartmental forum, to say who really is to be. I remember we were even sitting in one of the road forum meetings chaired by Honorable Minister in the presidency when the issue between the city and the state arose with that court case. Up to now, this issue has not been resolved. I think the committee will really ask, if the committee can assist us in that regard, I think it will, just to fast check that it will make our work on the border easy, because we really don't have the capacity, the budget, and the capability to be erecting, maintaining the fence all across the border. The status of the fence right now is in disrepair. I think it's fair to say. I hear Honorable Mena say that he crossed the border and did the interview in Zimbabwe. I understand that, and I can't even imagine where Honorable Mena crossed it. Because
it was not with Mugabe, though.
But honorable members, it is a serious it actually is very frustrating. I can say that maybe one of the oversight visits, if it has not been done, we can do oversight visits to be with our soldiers on the border, literally. And look at the facilities they are living in. Look at the work that they look at the difficulties that they have, and look at the limitations of our budget. I know that we are going to the Air Force, and now we are finishing a report on the Air Force. I would hope that Honorable Members, their next report is on the deployed members of the Defense Force along our borders, to see how we can help us, especially in terms of the facilities and the budget, and also engaging other departments personally. I think the Department of Public Works must come to the party and put up the fence and maintain it properly. There was an issue of the Sonabo contract that was raised. The question was who was the DG. I think it must have been Mr. Smith at the time during that period. And I don't have the information as to who owns Autumn Star Trading. I think we will have to find that information, but it's not going to be that easy if you think about it. When people are bidding for the process, when you bid for a service in the Department of Defense, you have that form that you fill up, which states who are you, who owns you, police record, tax clearance, and everything. We have that form. But in this particular case, because, as I think Honorable Medina has indicated, it was part of the obligations of the DIP of obligation, the engagement was with staff. To say staff, got a contract, you have obligations according to this contract, help us with this project of building a plant to desensitize our aged ammunition so that they can become safe. So it was in that process where the staff says, yes, we're going to do that, we'll get our local partner obligation, DTI, got involved. So it was those monitoring, DTI monitoring the obligations. And then the question was, how many credits the staff going to get out of it? And then it was at one stage, so many credits, then another stage, so no, when you calculate your credits are going to be so much. And staff says, oh, if you, those are the number of credits you're going to give you, they are not worth it, I'm pulling out of this contract. Staff pulled out of the contract after the contract has been processed and signed in that manner. And now, as you know, the case is in court. Because Sonabo says we violated that contract. So it's really subject to decay. We can't say much detail about it, but I think there's a specific question
come alive. As well.
What happens in Mamo, the length of a transitional contract is it adequate, I think, here, General Hospital to cover. Honorable Daniel, consequences of non compliance, the record, it is part of the PFMA that when there is non compliance with the PFMA, there must be recourse, there must be action taken. Within the department, we are beginning to focus on that. Actually, if the resources were adequate within the Office of the Secretary for Defense, I would like to set up what we can call a compliance division, because this department is so big. In the meantime, though, let's strengthen the capacity of the internal audit and see how far assistance will get there. The infrastructure is there in the department. I think we do, while we complain about other things, we should be, I think, thankful for the other things that we have in the Department of Defense that can assist us in our compliance. Because we do have military police, I mean, MP, not members of parliament, military police, which other departments don't have. We have defense intelligence, which other departments might not have. We have Inspector General and the Military Justice Court that take people to court. And we do have constitute, in terms of policy, what you call boards of inquiry, properly constituted, run with all the support infrastructure of military justice, defense, intelligence, investigators, and military police to take action. So you will find that if it is a member of the armed forces, a member in uniform, military courts take place in our environment, the courts take place, military courts take place, consequences which might include imprisonment, although our soldiers don't want to be imprisoned in the Department of Correctional Services of prisons, which might mean dismissal, which might mean financial judgment against them, depending on the involvement. So on the issue of the AMG, yes, there is a board of inquiry that is running in terms of the monitoring of that contract, how was that contract monitored, and the person, if that person is found guilty, then there will be consequences. But as you know, even in our military justice, the suspect is innocent until proven otherwise. Although I like our military democracy, because there's one man democracy, whose commander is the one who issues the democratic.
Sounds very democratic.
You're here to protect democracy, not practice it.
So there are consequences, Honorable Daniel, that we can really should be able to prefer to. The full report on the South African airport, I was not aware that we owe the committee full report. Definitely, we'll be compliant and work with Nindy as soon as that is properly reflected. The General Master can look at that report for us. And the issue of AMSCO and Denel, maybe the committee might like to take it up at a different level, because AMSCO has got its own board, and the chairman of the board reports to the minister. I interact a lot with the accounting officer in terms of our operational service level agreement. We have a service level agreement. We transfer funds to AMSCO. Service level agreement with AMSCO, I maintain, I monitor the implementation. As an accounting officer, I'm reporting to monitor that service level agreement that we have with AMSCO. And if Denel then is not compliant with certain legislation, I think that issue of Denel will have to be raised strongly with appropriate oversight committees that include the public enterprise, because Denel reports to public enterprise. But AMSCO reports to this committee in terms of, I think, oversight. So we might raise the issues there.
If there's anything else that we need to raise on our part, we'll be happy to assist. And labor laws, I think, that are related to the AMG or liability. General Masters will okay, but when it comes to liability, I was saying that that's not my class responsibility. No, we're not liable for the retrenchment of those employees, but when I look at the contract, then the lawyers told me otherwise. So it's all on the contract that was signed in 1986, renewed, amended, and approved, and so forth, in terms of what happens when you terminate this contract. Maybe my colleagues suit that contract, but the lawyers will address that. And that's where the discussions are at a very sensitive stage right now. Of course, from the Department of Defense, and then also from the Department of Public Enterprise on the other side. And when it comes to the issues of the HR issues related to the Department of Defense, actually, as the Department of Defense, I strongly believe that we are maybe one of the major institutions in terms of training capabilities and building capacity for the country as a whole. Whether you talk in terms of doctors and nurses, or talk of engineers, technicians, or you talk in terms of teachers and lawyers, any other capability, we send people out. So then it's under general, I think we do say that we face it all the time after people have gone through the scholarship, okay, pilots as well as you know, and others. Then we need to enforce that contract that if you have been trained using the resources and of the Department of Defense, then you have to give back to the Department of Defense before you can go to the private. If you are a pilot, we train you as a pilot, and then after that, the United Arab Emirates Airlines offers you three times, four times as much as you can get in the airport. Well, you can't just walk away if we are the ones who train you as a pilot. So there are those contractual issues that policies, HR policies that have put in place, but I wouldn't be able to agree with you more when you said that critical, we must in the Defence Force recruit committed individuals who join the Defence Force because they want to serve. To join the Defence Force because you are looking for an employment, or you want to be a pilot, you want to be a doctor, you want to be, and you are not joining because you want to serve, then I think we would have these difficulties where I would say that anything people don't say, and there's I think the chief of the South African Defense Force, Jamal Chauke, is very particular about that, passionate about that. He has even published a document that he calls Profile of a South African Soldier. I think once you get that document out, profile what is the profile of a South African soldier into the public, so that before people can join, they must see themselves whether do they fit into this profile of a South African soldier. We can save a lot of these issues in terms of making sure that we have deserving members becoming members of the South African Defence Force that we can all be proud of. Honourable Mr. Boy, on the issues of perceptions, I agree. You know, to the eyes of the perceiver, perceptions are a reality. You know, you can't say perceived, and that's what that has been really the pain with my with this report. But I mean, when you look at that graph there, it does show you that the consultants are not really 10.4 billion. They are red here in that report. So the consultants maybe they're down to how much? 400,000. For this year, so I would have been so happy if the Auditor General said, over this period of audit, the amount spent by the Department of Defense on consultants was 1,000 million. I'm sorry. Well, but better still red and without rather to say. It was 11 billion. That's what they say, right? The perception out there is that we spent 11 billion. Whereas actually their report
in reality, if you had to spend 450 million, if you spend 450 million, it would have been a better conception rather than to say we spend 10 billion on construction. I want to help us get the message out there.
Oh,
I don't have a budget. And so I think it will really help us with that kind of position. That's why we will, I think most of the comments that you're making, I do agree with you. And then also in terms of the compliance with the laws, I think in general terms, the law that they're talking about, each time when they talk about the law for me as an accounting officer, it means PFMA. So is the department compliant with PFMA? Is it not? I think also, I think it's fair to look at those as a trend. It will be interesting to look at the matters of emphasis for the financial year 2010, 2011, and the matters of emphasis raised by Dr. Jerome for financial year 11, 12. There's been drastic reduction. I think what the general sitting next to you will concur that in terms of our compliance with the PFMA, we are doing better and better every year. And hopefully this year we'll maintain that trend as well. And the issues, I think, of ensuring that the implementation then of the solution to the problem with ANG will take into account the transformation and the transfer of skills. I think that at this point, let me ask a General Masters just to take us through this issue, this difficult period that we're facing, because negotiations are still going on with the unions, particularly I think it's mostly Solidarity and others, in terms of ensuring that sensitive information that is being discussed there doesn't come out. But yes, we're talking about people's lives, people's careers, and people's pension, as we indicated, and their retrenchment, which is a very painful subject, and I think it needs to be treated with the humanitarian touch that it deserves.
Thank you, sir. I
will.
Listened to you very carefully and I ticked off the questions which I believe you have already answered. So I will focus on those which has not been. If I start to answer one of those questions which you prefer to answer, then you can show me and I will be quiet. I think that the first question is with regards to consequences for Air Force capability. We have actually been interacting and listening to the advice of the Auditor General for a long time. And so a robust way of a needs assessment has been a part of what we did. So reaching that number of 139 was based on the fact that these are skills which are essential and the skills which are scarce. What we mean by scarce is that with people whom we currently have in the Air Force, we are not able to replace them with people who are currently in the Air Force. So essentially the skill is essential, it is needed for our capability, and it is so scarce that we cannot ramp up individuals who are in the Air Force to be able to execute those. So with regards to saying, have we covered all the risk, I, as a military person, I won't say that, because that's what our business is about. However, we have listened to the Auditor General and put a very robust needs assessment tool in place in order to determine what we see there. So, basically, we feel that we've done as much as we can to address the short-term capability risk.
Sorry, General, what you can, not what you want.
Excuse me?
What you can, not what you want.
Yes, I think that is correct.
Yeah.
But what we could do, we have done. I think I've answered those. First of all, you're going to address the deal with the inability to play competitive panelists. I think it's something we have a very comprehensive plan. about the current funding levels and the current dispensations in terms of the Defence Act Section 55 and the Public Service Act, that there are certain constraints which does not allow the DOD. But I think this was tackled even from our previous minister's time in terms of the establishment of a permanent place. Defence Service Commission would look at these matters. But obviously, and I don't think this is something which we need to go back and back on, we can only offer salaries within the provisions in the Defence Act, and when it comes to civilian employees of the Air Force, within the provisions of the Public Service Act. That was answered. I think you also answered Mr. Moore's question. Pass that one.
I don't have the money to something.
The demographics of the 139 Danelle people is 130 white males and 9 black males. The labor law issues has been covered. I can't go any further in that. It's a matter of legal interpretation. The next question was also answered. I believe all of the questions were answered.
Chair, my question wasn't answered.
You done, General?
No, I'm still busy. I was referring to extend those questions,
yeah,
that all our questions have been covered. And then with Mr. Boy's question, I think it was answered. The first one was answered by the second. And I started that thing to the current funding of the group of matches. I don't think any of them are interested. How do you intend to develop skills? I think the secretary probably put it very aptly, that the Defence Force, when we are not at war, we are the biggest training institution in the country. So we are always developing skills for training. It may be interesting to know that most of the aviation industry outside of the Defence Force were trained by the South African Air Force. With respect to the feasibility study report we've done, I think you would like to have the results of that feasibility study or sort of thing. I will take that back to the Chief of the Air Force and consultation. And then how we close the gap between others and
except the areas I've classified.
There's a classified.
That's the easiest case. I am classified, don't worry. Top secret.
With regards to the areas where Danelle has been serving us with 500 and odd people, and now we can reduce it 139. I think she was hit in the context of that study which we had, and basically I'll explain. If we have people within the Air Force who over a short period of time and with our own training means we can bring them up to a level to execute it, then those people do not need to. So it is simply just in complying with the auditing and those requirements that we have a robust assessment needs, that we have a very robust one, and looking at is it essential? And is it so scarce that you cannot replace the person from within the Air Force currently, then we kept it. So that is how that 139 people came to do. So I think I've now answered the question twice, but from two different angles. With regards to why we're not developing enough young people and focusing on pensioners, I think that this has been our problem. We do develop a lot of young people every year, and I think it might be a fact of not only greater demands on the Air Force, but I think basically it's broader with the number of things which we do in the South African economy. So there's a great attraction. We have, for instance, over many years, we've lost a lot of aviation technicians, not to other aviation companies, but to cell phone companies. Other types of electronics.
Sorry, to what?
To sell.
telephone companies or to electronic companies, so not necessarily to other aviation companies. So I think I covered all the questions which I just have noted.
You done, General?
Yes, I am.
Any more questions? Honorable Charles, Honorable Muir, Honorable Nana.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I think the question we all like to know is the contingency plan that is in place. We hear, and I think the questions raised speak to that issue of 139 critical posts that we understand. But the balance of the 538 may not be that critical. But in the meantime, is the Defence Force going to re-advertise, because those are generic skills in the market and many people can apply for the posts? Come, it's already the, we've gone out, the end of this month is coming to the 1st of March when it's terminated. The 1st of April kicks in. People are dismissed. There's a temporary plan in place, transitional plan, which speaks to 139 people. Is the Defence Force looking at a contingency plan now of advertising generic skills that they will interview people and have them re-employed as permanent or contract workers with SANDF and not with with Danal or with AMG? Those are the real issues. What contingencies in place to make things work the 1st of April?
There will be issues of labor relations as we ramp up the capability in-house. You will always have those who are, we call them TSAP staff, Public Service Act staff. And the Public Service Act states exactly all the compliance that we need to follow when you are appointing somebody in a Public Service Act environment. Then you have what you call the Defense Act. Now, those are the men and women in uniform. Now, I think for those who are now members of the Air Force today, I think as the Master was indicating, some of them actually have those skills. In other words, it's not to say that there is zero skills. I mean, I can also carry for the gun panel, as a member. And that's what other people are doing, just moving things around there. In the AMG people, there are people who are just moving things around, careers. So they can come in. But we are saying that some of these capabilities, even in that area of a specialized team, we do have our own technicians who are in uniform as members of the Air Force. Others have been trained over the years and continue, this training has been continuous. So that even if the consultants were doing the work, the fact of the matter is that the reason we're able to ramp down so quickly from 500 to 100 is because we have been complaining ourselves that, you know what, we can do this thing. What AMG is doing, it can be done. We have now a new a team of young stars, young women and men of all colors, truly representative of our new South Africa, who are out there in the faces, moving up and down, and others end up driving trucks because AMG is doing the work. So we just take them and say, AMG, we don't need these people because that we have people here who can already do the work. Come 1st of April, they move out of driving a truck, they go straight to the hell. They do the job. They've been trained to do it, but someone else has been.
Yeah, no, I just want to know if they is.
Okay.
But I think it would be important, maybe General Masters will discuss with this and see, because I think that's going to be very important for the members of the committee, just for us to present the plan of the transitional plan, because it's going to be 12 months and it's not going to be easy. So I think we need to take into consideration
should have said that in the beginning.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. And I would certainly support the Secretary of Defense's suggestion that the transitional plan be presented in detail, because from what we've heard today, I would suggest that the transitional plan has the potential at least to wobble. But let me come back to my first question. My first question is, what would the effect of the termination of the AMG contract be on the capability and the safe operations of aircraft in the SAS? Please answer the question. What is the effect on the VIP squadron? What is the effect on 2 squadron? What is the effect on 85 squadron? Please answer my question directly. The second question is the transition. The essence of the transition plan is to retain 139 personnel. My question was, it does not seem to me plausible that we will, or that the department will succeed in effectively transferring the skills which have been built up, as we've heard, over 20 years in 12 months. That's the first question. The second question is, how confident is the department that they will actually retain those 139 individuals? They, after all, are the most skilled members, and the department is going to be in competition with the private sector for those 139 individuals. Chair, from what my analysis of the transition plan is, it seems to me that there's a serious risk that over the next 12 months it's going to wobble, and there will be consequences for the capability and the safe operations of the SAF.
What do you suggest? What do you suggest should be done?
No.
The department says it's retaining the scarce skills, right? But which means that the department has realized that if it shares the risk, we might have a negative effect in this case. I just want you to also suggest to the department, if you do not agree with that. Honorable Nana?
Well, thanks. My apologies for coming late. I had to attend a farewell parade in Grahamstown this morning at 5 o'clock. Soldiers are leaving from the RC, Goma region.
Now I've given you an amnesty.
It just doesn't stop boggling my mind. I can't stop to imagine the amount of publicity would this contract have enjoyed had it been signed after 1994. I mean, from where I'm sitting, it smells everything. It smells everything. Corruption to say the least. And yet our media hasn't picked it up. Probably they have picked it up, they know benefit it, and they don't see it as a matter of national interest. But having said that, Chair, I wanted to suggest to you, Chair, that when the Secretary for Defense was responding to some of the questions, he mentioned something which was, again, quite intriguing to me, that in the forum of whichever department, they are still debating whose responsibility it is to erect and maintain the fence. I just can never understand this, Chair. The security of the country is at risk. People are moving in and out of the loopholes in our fences, including Honorable Mayor. our country's security is being compromised, and yet here are finest brains in our country, DG, the Secretary of Defense, are still debating whose responsibility might it be. I mean, to me, I would then suggest that if you would agree with me that maybe we should try and get in contact with committees, with other committees that are directly involved in this, your public works and whoever else sits in this forum, and try and stretch it out from this level and see if we can. Can't really move this as fast as we could. Because, I mean, quite naturally, Chair. No, let me stop there. And lastly, Chair, I know many people around this table are definitely Kaizer Chiefs supporters. Very few should be married. We have a game today here at Athlone, which is playing against Chiba. No, that's only federal. I mean, you guys can afford it. Today we'll be opening a 6-point lead, Chair, because apparently you lose to football day Thursday. So everyone is invited to come and watch.
I think you're offering it.
I think the members of the committee should get complimentary. Number one, Chair. Now, look, there is no ambiguity as to whose responsibility is. You had it when we went on oversight investigation to who's responsible for this public facility. It's public work. Now, as a committee, because you were talking about a work regiment, as a committee, we should be asking how far is that process of a work regiment? Because you know, public work does not deliver, it's supposed to deliver.
Thank you. I mean, just to also emphasize that we will prepare. I mean, we will prepare a presentation on this transitional plan, and but I will let General Masters address that issue of the impact of safety. Can we develop a skill in 1 year? How confident are we that we'll be able to retain even the 139? But all of these questions can be answered if we present a comprehensive plan that will cover all of, because the next question will be what's going to happen after 12 months. And all of these issues, I think, can be addressed once we bring the whole plan to the committee. But General Masters, the issue of safety, of course, you must respond to.
The only way I can put this is to say that there are no risks which doesn't exist today, which will suddenly exist once they are reduced to 100%. I can't predict the future, but I know that what we did in our feasibility study was to determine what are essential tasks currently executed or done in the Defence Force, in the Air Force, by AMG personnel. And then we made a list of those which are essential. And then we looked at what are the scarcity of personnel within the Air Force with respect to being able to do those essential functions. And if there were people within the Air Force with whom the person could be replaced, then we replaced that person. So what we could say, if you look at it, of the total number of people who are on the AMG contract, you now have 139, and the balance has been replaced by people within the Air Force who is able to do that work, but who are already within the Air Force. So I'm giving an expression of our needs assessment that we did, that we wanted only those essential ones, and which cannot be replaced with people who are not already in the Air Force. So those are the ones who were replaced, is the ones which we do have people. So that is the extent which I can say, that there are no new risks which are going to arise purely because of the people being their contract terminating at the end of March. Of course, six quadrants which you've mentioned, it remains the same as the overall arrest. There is nothing which we've done to the VVIP squadron, to two squadron, to any of our bases, that we now say we are not going to have these people continue with the contract, and as a result of that you can now not do certain things. I think that although we are very clear with regards to our concerns about the current funding levels and our concerns about our ability to act on it, but we most definitely did not and will not, you see, take actions where we knowingly reduce capabilities for which the Air Force has a mandate to execute. And I think that is the best way which I can answer the question. We have not let go of anybody. Now in that person's absence, the Air Force cannot execute its mandate, its essential mandate of what we are able to execute today. There is nobody who has been told, we don't need your services because we want to prove a point that we won't have a capability. And with respect to the transfer skills within 12 months, I have to absolutely agree with you, but I think maybe the actual plan has to be presented because it sounds like a mechanical issue of you transferring skills to another person. It obviously cannot work in that way. We need to go into the South African market, and that is why there's a reference to the current dispensation which restricts us. We really need to go into the South African market and source skilled young people. We do have them in South Africa. Some of them were trained by the South African Air Force. We have flight test engineers who were trained by the South African Air Force but left at a very young age. We have these people. So we cannot, it's not a question of the current people working for the now passing the skills on. It is not possible for a flight test engineer to pass his skill on to another person who is not. So we need to sort highly skilled people and bring them into the Air Force if we were to make this transition of 12 months. So it is definitely not the case of individuals transferring their knowledge in the field. These are highly trained, highly educated people we are talking about. On the other hand, there are people who are skilled artisans who have become more used to working on specific types of aircraft. In those cases, we have skilled artisans who have worked on other aircraft who can learn from that person, but that is not the same as the type of skill process. And almost the vast majority of the 139 are people whom it takes years of training and years of exposure and experience to reach the levels which we have. So that is not, I can only echo what the secretary said. One can't really be given confidence that it can be done by merely the level of discussion which we are able to have now. And so maybe the comprehensive plans presentation is probably a bit away.
Thank you very much. Are you done?
I think it's okay.
Honorable members, maybe what we should do, we should ask the subject to submit the transition plan by next week, and by the 20th of this month, then we will come and do a presentation.
I will just maybe request to negotiate the timing of it. Because once I present it out in public, I want to be able to negotiate with the unit. But we will work with the time that I just provided. It shouldn't be. If you have challenges, you have a challenge.
No, it's fine. I think we've come to the end of our meeting.
I'm going to go to the hospital.
Thank you. think only the three of them would have signed.
I'm going to see if she can keep having you to act.